Hey, good evening, everybody. It's the Tri-State Sports Guys coming to you live from beautiful Norwalk, Connecticut. I'm Mike DePalma alongside my co-host Danny Santarella. Got Tony D behind the glass.
Yep.
Got a couple good guests lined up tonight. I'm pretty excited. We've got your main man, Tad Boyle, who I'm sure is your best friend after this weekend's events.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure
yeah,
he is.
Exactly.
We got Mark Long, former Road Rules contestant. He's done all kinds of reality shows, and does after shows. There's all kinds of things. Now he's got a book coming out, a fitness book.
They still do that show? I used to love that show.
I don't know if they
do.
We'll ask Mark.
Yeah, let's ask him.
I don't know. I never watched it. I don't think I've ever seen it, but I know he's famous for it,
yeah.
So that's good. And we got Brandon Meller from Seminoles.com coming on to talk about Florida State. So I'm super excited about the whole entire show. I mean, we got so much to get to. The thing is, like, there's all these things going on in the sports world, and we have this whole agenda we want to get to. And then a story breaks on a Wednesday night that I feel like we should dedicate, maybe not the full 2 hours, hour and a half on it. You know what I'm talking about. Bartolo Colon signing with the Mets.
$20 million, is that what it was?
2 for $20. Now, granted, the guy has pitched very well. His little resurgence he had with the Yankees, obviously 2 years ago he got suspended, but he was pitching well before he got suspended for the PEDs. And he comes back last year. And, you know, it was in contention for a Cy Young Award. He got a 2.6 ERA, 18-6. But you just, when I first heard it, my heart sank a little bit. I know it's probably wrong. You're looking like you're getting a guy who is a Cy Young contender, looking at those stat lines for $10 million per year. Like, that's a steal in this day and age and in this market and everything. But,
Is it because he looks better in a baseball uniform than you ever did?
Well, that's what it is,
what
mostly.
It is?
But the idea of just watching him in a batter's box, taking cuts with that gut.
Yeah.
Oof. I mean, I just think of, like, Levon Hernandez, God bless him, he'll give up 6-7 runs, but he'll give you 6-7 innings. I don't think Bartolo Colon is at that stage yet, but it's going to happen, and it's going to happen in a Mets uniform,
yeah.
Which is fitting. That's what the Mets team is, like, a place where old people go to just retire. It's like a little old, it's like a little, like, halfway house. You're not fully in, like, hospice, but you're in that, like, you know, like, let me just go someplace comfortable.
Right.
I get to wear the nice orange underneath my jersey. It's
yeah.
great. And you get to do that, and that's what Bartolo Colon's doing. And so I'm wondering, like, you know, I wrote this article about David Price, which I thought did make sense. That whole thing, giving
yeah.
up a Syndergaard, all these guys that can't give up prospects. It's what the Mets always say, you can't give up prospects, and yet none of them pan out. And now I'm thinking to myself, well, my first reaction was this puts the nail in that coffin because now they're not going to add another pitcher. But on the flip side of that, it's almost like, yeah, now they can. Because, you know, Syndergaard, if he comes up this year, he's going to be a 5, and that means somebody has faltered, whether it's Mejia or G or somebody has faltered. They still have Montero down there. And so you wonder to yourself, well, yeah, maybe this could work because now it makes Syndergaard a little bit more expendable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't wait to get for me to stop talking about Bartolo Colon. Just admit it.
No, I gotta be honest. I love listening to you
mm-hmm.
talk the Mets. It's great fun to me. But
why don't you listen to this?
Yeah.
Instead of you talking to me about Bartolo Colon and how overweight he is, I'm gonna give you a little treat.
What's that?
On the Tucci Lumber Hotline. Now you're Mr. College Basketball on this show.
Yep.
We have a guy, now as a Kansas fan, it might be a little difficult. I want you to work your way through it. I want your bottom lip to be stiff.
Okay.
And I want you to discuss this weekend's event with the one and only coach of the Colorado basketball team, Tad Boyle. Tad, are you with us?
I'm with you guys. How you doing?
Coach, we're good. We really appreciate you joining us. The first thing I just wanted to get into a little bit was, as a former Jayhawk, could you maybe be kind of honest? Did Isaiah Booker get an extra step there at the end of that game?
Oh, that's the Euro step jumper. It's been the Euro step, you know, layup in transition. Now it's the Euro step jumper, and everybody in college basketball is trying to replicate it.
Yeah, you know, Coach, it was a game that, you know, as a big Jayhawks fan, I obviously was upset at the end of it. But the fact of the matter was you guys just – you played better. You know, and the curious question I had for you was, how much did the Villanova game tape go into the kind of game plan you guys employed with the half-court trap and kind of playing a little bit of a smaller lineup at times? I know you don't have a ton of size, but how much did you guys study that Villanova game tape looking at the Jayhawks?
Well, we watched it. There's no question about it. You know, Villanova was the only team to beat them before we did. So we studied that. And, you know, what a lot of people don't realize, we were down a starter. Wes Martin, our sixth freshman power forward, who one of our best interior defenders and best rebounders, wasn't available for that game. And so we were down an interior guy. When you're playing Kansas front line, that's not a real good feeling going into that game. So we knew we were going to press them a little bit. You know, they're young. They've got young guards. We knew our atmosphere and the Coors Event Center was going to be live that night, and we wanted to see how they're going to handle it. And then we knew we were going to throw some zone. We're not a zone team, but, you know, wanted to make a jump shooting team, whether we played man or whether we played zone. But they're so good inside. They're such good post feeders and good post players. The zone was very effective for us.
Yeah, Coach, you know, one of the things with Kansas, as I know you obviously know, is Ellis and Embiid on the inside. And, you know, you put in your senior there, Mills, who, you know, does not play a lot. He played exceptionally well. And you held those two to a combined 20 points, and Embiid never even scored in the second half. Was it as much him, Mills, or was it Scott and other inside help? How did you shut down the big guys, especially Embiid, in that second half?
Well, Embiid really played well in the first half, and every time he caught it on the block, I mean, he seemed to score. I mean, he's a heck of a player, and he's just going to get better and better, there's no doubt. What we talked about at halftime, guys, is we talked about Embiid, we're not a double-the-post kind of team, but when he caught the ball in the post and put the ball on the floor, we had to be, you know, like sharks in the water, and our guards had to do a good job of really getting down there and digging it out. And Skia Booker, you know, everybody talks about the three he made, but he did a great job really digging on the post, as all our perimeter guys did, to give our post guys some help in the second half. We really limited Embiid's touches, and when he did touch it, we made him kick it back out. Perry Ellis, you know, good player. He was a matchup for us. And, we were fortunate to make that shot because at the end of the game, you know, Kansas was scoring pretty easily and pretty efficiently, and we would have had to go back to that zone if we went overtime.
Coach, before I get into your backcourt there with Booker and Dinwiddie, what were your thoughts on Wiggins on tape and then when you saw him play in the game? I know he put up over 20 against you guys, but you did a pretty good job containing him even with that said. What were your thoughts on him, seeing him on tape and then seeing him play right in front of you there?
That's amazing to mention that because I'm watching film with our on Saturday morning before the game, before we had pregame meal, and I told him, I said, guys, I don't see it with this kid on tape. I mean, he's, you know, I know he's hyped. I know he's a good player, but, you know, I think we can handle him. And then in person, you know, 4 hours later, and when that kid's in transition, you can't stop him. I mean, he's coming. He's like a freight train going downhill. He is so athletic. He's so long. He's so active. He's so quick and fast. I mean, in the open floor, he's a handful. He scored on us one time 1-on-5. So he's much, much better in person than watching him on 18 in the second half. And again, he's just going to be as good as he wants to be. He's in the game. I do think it's a little bit unfair. All the expectations and hype that's been put on that kid to try to live up to those is nearly impossible, but he's a special player and a special talent.
Speaking of talent, Coach, I think your backcourt there with Booker and Dinwiddie is not only underrated, but I think it's one of the better ones in the country. I know you guys had a tough time at Allen Fieldhouse last year, but I have seen your team play in the Pac-12. Just talk a little bit about those two and kind of how they jumpstart your offense, and they're both good defensive players. What do they mean to your ball club in the backcourt?
Well, they mean everything. I don't think you win in college basketball consistently and at a high level unless you play. And we're fortunate to have both those guys. They're both juniors. Spencer has started every game in here. Skia was a sixth man coming up this freshman year. You know, started his entire sophomore year. So they've got a lot of experience for juniors. Spencer Dinwiddie is as good a point guard as there is in the country. 6. He can affect the game in so many different ways. You know, Before we played Kansas, we played Colorado on the road, you know, a couple front rivals here. You know, against Colorado State, he has 28 points, puts the team on his back in the second half and takes over the game. The game before that, Air Force, he takes five shots, scores 7 points, gets his teammates involved. I mean, he can do whatever it takes done as a point guard to get your team a win. And he's always thinking about the first, about his teammates, and he's going to do whatever he can do to help you win. And then Booker, just like, you know, he's dynamite. I mean, he's very explosive. He can get hot and score in bunches. Very talented, to get his own shot. And when he's on, our team's really tough to stop.
Coach, how do you feel those guys match up when you start getting – I know you can't get too ahead of yourself. You've got some non-conference games coming up. But how do those guys match up with the backcourts you see at Arizona, UCLA, even Oregon, Utah? You feel like you might have one of the best ones out there in the Pac-12?
I think we do. And there's some good backcourts in – you know, you just mentioned, you know, Oregon and Arizona and Utah. I mean, there's good backcourts in the Pac-12. There's no question about it, I think. But I'll take those two over anybody. I wouldn't trade them for anybody. I love them. They're both great kids. They both came to Colorado and committed to us and signed on with the Buffalo before we had us, you know, we were making the move from the Big 12 to the Pac-12. They're both L.A. kids. So L.A. is obviously an important recruiting area for us. And to have those two kids, you know, sign on and say, hey, we believe in you, believe in what you're doing, and then to come here and have the success we've had, I'm forever grateful to them and loyal to them, just like they've been loyal to us.
Yeah, Coach, you mentioned recruiting, and I know you guys, I believe it was your first top 25 recruiting class ever in Boulder. You know, how are you doing that at what's been considered for a long time a football school? And on top of it, you're now packing the Coors Event Center, which for years, I remember Kansas going in there in Big 12 play. The place was full of Kansas fans, or it was half empty, or whatever it was. How, you know, what is the design that you have in order to turn Colorado into a basketball power now?
Well, it's just, you know, it's just old hard work. And recruiting is all about building relationships and building trust and with high school coaches, parents, kids. Our staff, my coaching staff, John Prelo and Mike Rohn and Rodney, they do an unbelievable job recruiting, and we work hard every day. And so it starts with recruiting players, and then, you know, to you got to believe in whatever you're selling. And Colorado basketball has had pockets of success around Chauncey Billups back in the 90s, David Harrison in the early 2000s. What we haven't had is sustained success, and we're trying to build sustained success here at Colorado. And the only way you do that is by working hard every day and believing in what you got. And we've got a special situation here in Boulder. And when people visit, they see it. They see our new facilities. They see our new practice gym. They see the passion of the Buffalo fans. It's just kind of built every year upon itself. We don't intend to stop.
Yeah, I'll tell you this, Coach. It's extremely impressive. Like I said, I remember watching Kansas go out there for years and years in the Big 12, and it was just a lot of beatdowns. I know Coach Bizdelic did a good job there. But you obviously played at Kansas. You played for Ted Owens and Larry Brown. What is the difference there between the atmosphere at KU, the atmosphere at Colorado over the years, and what was it like playing for those two great coaches?
Well, you know, I'm proud to have played at Kansas. It's a special place. And, you know, a guy like Ted Owens, who's, you know, actually called me the afternoon after the game, and Larry Brown, who's been a great influence on my life and my coaching career. To play for those guys was very special. You know, that means a lot to me. But at Colorado, again, I grew up in this state. This is where I'm from. And to try to build something in your home state and to have an opportunity like I have, I'm very fortunate. I'm very grateful. And to me, it's as good a place to play college basketball as there is. Allen Fieldhouse is special. I know Cameron Indoor and Assembly Hall. And there's a lot of nice places around the country. We're something special at the Coors Events Center, and anybody that watched that game on Saturday knows that.
Chad, it's Mike DePalma again. You know, I'm always fascinated by coaches and their stories and what makes them get into coaching. We had Sean Salisbury on last week, and he's talking about, you know, he would love to go back to college and coach quarterbacks. And I'm saying, you must be crazy. You got a good gig there at Yahoo Sports. What are you doing getting into coaching, which is really just a bunch of idiots on the radio telling you how you don't know what you're doing, or a bunch of fans telling you what you're doing. Now, you are a guy who got out of college, had a career, and gave that up to go be an assistant at Oregon. I mean, that's a leap of faith there, Coach, that not a lot of people would take. And so just walk me through that process. Was it just an itch you couldn't scratch anywhere else? You had to get back into the gym?
Well, it was a little bit of everything. It was a critical time in my life. I was 30 years old, 31, and you know, I had an opportunity in front of me. And basketball's always been a passion of mine. And once you're out of the game, like I was, and then I got back into it, you realize how much you, and you know, I was in the finance, and I was also coaching high school basketball. When my head hit the pillow at night, the bottom line is I was thinking about the kids I was coaching, thinking about how we could win the next game or build a better team the next, how many guys on the football team I could come out to be on the basketball team. That's where my thoughts were. And I wasn't thinking about interest rates or what the stock market was going to do the next day. Not that I didn't care about that. I just my was in the gym helping young men. And so I didn't want to be 50 years old, which is what I am now, looking back, what if I would have made that choice? And so I took faith, and it's worked out for me. But I did it because I love helping young men. I love the game of basketball. And I can't ever forget that, because sometimes when you get to this level, and the pressures come, and you know, and on all the things you have to deal with as a head basketball coach now, you can't forget why you got into it, and it is for the love of the game and trying to help young men.
Well, Coach, you know, we really appreciate your time. I'm pulling for you, even though you broke my co-host's heart this weekend, the biggest Kansas fan in Connecticut probably. You broke his heart, but I'm pulling for you. All the best to you and your program, and you're building something special over there, so we'll be watching you for the rest of the year. We really appreciate your time tonight.
No, I appreciate that. Remember, you can be a Kansas fan and a Colorado fan because we're not in the same league anymore. Just when we play each other, I know, you know, you might pull for the Hawks, but from now on, you can pull both of us.
Well, there you go. It's a little olive branch of peace for you there, Danny.
Well, I got to tell you, Coach, I always root for Coach Turgeon. I always root for Coach Manning. I always root for you. Just you got to stop beating the Jayhawks. Why don't you put a beating on Oklahoma State in a week or
two?
That's
the first time I've done it. So they needed that win more than they needed it. But I appreciate it. We're going to try to take care of the Cowboys in Vegas on the 21st. That's going to be another tough game.
Please do, Coach. And thanks again. And the best of luck to you guys the rest of the season and in the Pac-12 play. I wish you the best of luck.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. Coach of the Colorado Buffaloes, Tad Boyle. How'd that go for you? I mean, it was very good. You were very professional. I know you had a little – it was like, you know, it's a little tough because he's a former KU guy.
Yeah.
So you have that connection there. But he ripped your heart out this weekend. Let's not sugarcoat it.
I got to say two things.
You were miserable after that game.
I was miserable. Number one, they outplayed them.
Yeah.
Colorado.
Which
did.
You said off the air. Yep. You told me that.
And number two, and I'm not going to throw stones at Bill Self, but Tad Boyle outcoached him.
There you go.
So there it was. I mean, how upset could you be? I was furious, but I came down and I relaxed.
There you go. All right. We got to pay some bills. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about some college football. Another one of you. This is basically the Dan Santarella show featuring the Tri-State Sports guys. We're going to do all college sports, apparently, for the
Great.
First hour, and you're in your glory. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with the Tri-State Sports guys.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. Rioters, we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. Is anyone out there?
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.weebly.com.
Hey, All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys. Thanks again to Coach Tad Boyle from the Colorado Buffaloes hoops team. Let's talk some college football. I want to just ask you a few questions that are on my mind as a casual college football fan. And first and foremost, it kind of ties into the article that you wrote today. You know, all this talk that Mack Brown has done at Texas. I mean, all morning on the talk radio shows that I was listening to, they were talking about Nick Saban, possibility of going there. In my mind, now, I don't understand this, like, pecking order in college, like, what's the best job to get, but what in God's green earth would Nick Saban gain from leaving Alabama, which is a story, I mean, it's not like he just brought up Butler basketball, I mean, he brought up Alabama, which is one of the more storied college football programs in the nation's history. What motivation would he have to leave that and put together a run that he's put together since he's been there, which is as good as anybody in the last 40 years? What motivation would he have to leave there and go to Texas football? He could do nothing but get worse.
Well, I think to stay with a Kansas team for a sec, like Larry Brown. Larry Brown always seems to want to build, rebuild, those kinds of things. But here's what you have to remember, and I didn't even realize this till today. Mack Brown and Nick Saban are the same age. Mack's like 2 months older than him. They're both 62. No offense to Mack. I've always loved Mack, but Saban looks
like
a lot younger.
He looks like George Clooney. He's like a movie star.
But that's what four national championships will do for you. You know, it's kind of like that fountain of youth.
He's got no grays and no wrinkles.
Here's the thing with Coach Saban leaving at Bama. He's making $5.6 or $7 million a year.
Yeah.
They love him there. He's a demigod to those people. What salary wouldn't they match?
I mean, I'm guessing they would probably – Texas would have to come to the table with eight to start.
Well, to start, but then also what would Bama not match? They would have to match anything, okay? What Saban has now in Alabama is his pick of the litter. He pretty much handpicks the recruits he wants. Every time you watch the bottom line on ESPN or you pick up a friggin' paper or whatever, there's a top-ranked recruit from Texas going to Alabama.
Yeah.
Top-ranked kid from Utah last year. They got the top-ranked quarterback in the country from Utah.
Yeah,
to go there, not to Oregon, not to USC.
Yeah.
He goes to Bama.
To go to Bama.
So he handpicks who he wants.
Gets the kids out of Tallahassee, gets the kids out of Miami.
Absolutely. So now he goes to Texas, and they're nowhere near where Bama is right now with the talent that they have. Now he's got to recruit against A&M. He's got to recruit against Art Briles and Baylor. He's got to recruit against Bob Stoops and Mike Gundy from the Oklahoma schools. To me, it's a no-brainer. You just stay at Alabama.
That's what I'm saying. I can't even – people are honestly – entertaining this idea that he would do this. Is it even a possibility? He wasn't even on your list
today.
It's
a possibility. But the thing about it is there's a contract extension on the table for him that he has not signed. And people in Alabama are blowing it out of proportion, I think. Maybe he's going to go to Texas. But I can't see a scenario where he would think that's greener pastures for him. He is a guy right now outside that stadium. There's a statue to Paul Bear Bryant and Nick Saban.
And Nick Saban.
Okay? The guy wins four national championships, one of them at LSU. Okay,
mm-hmm.
He did a good job at Michigan State. He did a good job at LSU. He's doing an unbelievable, almost unprecedented modern-day football job at Alabama. I can't see any scenario where he would get fired from there.
Oh, yeah.
He's on par right now with Mike Krzyzewski. And I'll give you something interesting I heard from Christian Laettner a few years ago. He said, when they were talking about Krzyzewski leaving Duke for the L.A. Lakers, he said, a king doesn't leave his kingdom to go be a prince somewhere else. To me, that's what Nick Saban would be. I mean, he's a huge name. He'd be huge if he ever stepped foot in Austin in the burnt orange jacket and everything. But why?
Right.
Why would you when you're going to land arguably the number one or two recruiting class this coming year? Kids from the year following class are already lined up to go to Alabama.
Right.
You get every skill position player, every guy in the trenches that you want. You know, the one thing he apparently needs is a kicker. So, you know, but everything else, you know what I mean? It's like I can't see any program right now that could offer him a better deal than Alabama when Alabama's president said he's the best investment, Saban is, the school's ever made.
Oh, yeah.
The school, not the athletic department, the school, because of the money he's brought in, which I think is $140 million in the last, like, 4 years.
Of course. I mean, Alabama's going to match whatever it is. But even if they don't and there's, like, a little bit of a difference or whatever, I mean, he's got to – you come into work every day and you walk past your statue.
Yeah.
Someday we're going to have a statue of you per Ernie Banks at some point. And then you couldn't leave us to go to ESPN or anything.
No.
Would you? If we had a statue outside the studio?
I would leave you for a part-time gig with Jayhawk Radio. That's about
right now,
it.
If they call you up.
That's about it.
Your boys. I mean, I just it's more of a global question about this pecking order of what job is better than what job. Like, who says that? It happens in basketball, like the UCLA job. Well, that's a step up, and so-and-so should move over to UCLA. To me, in college basketball, UConn became a destination place because of Calhoun. Mm-hmm. And he made that now a place. So why can't another coach just make – Nick Saban has made Alabama, in my mind, the best place to coach, because right now they are the pinnacle of college football. Their fan base is just a rabid fan base. They got national games all the time. I mean, it's like as good as they can get. So I just it's more of like a one of the frustrations I have with this, with college sports in general. Like, who, why is that a better job? In what, in whose opinion? Is it the sports writers? Is it the idiots on ESPN that just say, well, Texas is a more desirable job? How could anything be more desirable than just being number one or two or three every year at Alabama?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, after the 2005 season when Texas won the national championship in the Rose Bowl out there, you could make the argument that that was the most desirable job in the country, and Mack Brown had it. And Mack Brown, I don't know, to answer your question, what makes something more desirable. Why is Alabama more desirable than Georgia or Virginia Tech or whatever? Maybe it's just winning.
Right.
Maybe that's it. Because when Saban was at LSU, that was a desirable job, and now Les Miles is there, and it's a desirable job because he's a good football coach.
Yeah, right, right.
But to me, the whole thing about one program being better than another, how's USC look right now?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I mean, it looks like trash. Sarkisian's a good coach, so he'll go in there and do whatever he does. Kiffin's a clown. That's why that program stinks.
Yeah.
I mean, Pete Carroll did irreparable damage to that program before he left it.
He won a lot of games, though.
Yeah, he won a lot of games out there. But I don't look at it like Alabama's a better job than Texas. I don't think it's a better job than Notre Dame. They're all huge jobs.
That's
the Penn State job's
huge. I get Urban Meyer leaving Utah. Right, that's where he was before he got on the floor. Like, I get that. Like, that's clearly a step up. You know, like, the guy from Butler is now coaching for Boston. Like, he's going to get a bunch of offers. I get that. Like, Butler's never going to have the dollars and stuff.
Right.
But, like, Alabama is Alabama, which, in my mind, as a casual football fan, is in the same – they're all in the same bunch.
Yeah.
It's like that second class of NFL quarterbacks that are all, like, you could take one or leave one. They're all kind of the same. To me, you get into the Texases – the Alabama, Florida, Notre Dame, these USC, even like all these, like, they're all the same. They're all interchangeable. It's not like you're going from, you know, Western Illinois to Florida. I get that move.
Right.
I don't get a move. It seems like a parallel move at best.
I think, you know, to your point, the only way a guy of Nick Saban's caliber leaves Tuscaloosa for Austin is just a mental thing where he says, I'm sure it's dollars and cents. If Texas comes in, like you said, at 8, and Bama goes, the best we can do is 6.7, then, you know, you get it at that point. But to make the argument that one school is better than the other, I think what he has to look at is, you know what, I've done what I could do at Alabama. I'm at the top of the mountain right now. The only place to go is down. Unless I win national championships, he's going to be like a Yankee. He's going to be like a New York Yankee. Unless I win it all, I'm going to be a bum. If I go to Texas next year and we turn it around and go 10-2, 11-1, or we compete for the Big 12 championship, now I'm a great coach.
It's kind of like the Bill Parcells thing. Like, he squammed the
jump
around.
What can he do from where he is now?
Mr. Turnaround Program type thing. But let me ask you this. Final question on this and we'll move on.
Yeah.
If he were to leave, do they have to take that statue down, right? I mean, you built a statue for the guy.
That's a good question.
But if this guy leaves in the middle of their dynasty for more money and all of a sudden next year Alabama – recruiting class isn't good, they're an 8-4 team or whatever, and they go back to the Alabama of the last 15 years, can they keep that up? And you're watching Texas on Saturdays, just dominating the...
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you remember a handful of years ago, Billy Donovan, Florida Gators basketball coach, he was going to take the Magic job, and he thought it over for a second, said, you know what, I want to be able to come back to Gainesville the rest of my life and enjoy what I built there. So maybe Coach Saban needs Coach Donovan's number.
Yeah, that's what
and
I mean.
Can talk a little bit because I'm with you. I would want to enjoy that. I mean, think about it. We joke about Ernie Banks building a statue for me. But think about if someone actually built one for you.
Yeah, right.
I mean, now you are a pretty cool guy. If you went to Johns Hopkins, there was a statue of
you.
You
just go down to JHU.
Yeah, I mean, you're just...
Homewood Field. And
yeah, you're the
guy. There's a statue of me there,
for the rest of your life.
Well, right. And not only that, I'm talking about even just dollars and cents. Like, say they do give him an extra $1 or $2 million a year. That job is no longer guaranteed. If he doesn't go there and start winning 10, 11 games a year, he'll be out.
Yeah.
Mack Brown was a fantastic coach, and they're talking about, you know, he's out. So he could, like you said, he could be at Alabama like Bobby Bowden was at FSU until the day he dies.
Yeah.
He's there until they tell him, you know, you can't physically walk to the field anymore.
Yeah.
He's Joe Paterno. Like, he's that in that status. He's now giving that up and risking all of that for a couple extra $1 million up front, but looking at it, if I make his agent say, like, no, you have guaranteed income. It's like you have a pension. And you're like, well, I'm making $100,000 in my pension. If I take another job, I'm going to lose it, but I might make $120,000 for the next 5 years,
yeah.
And hopefully that pans out. If I'm the guy's financial advisor, I'm saying, dude, you have $100,000 a year for the rest of your life. Take it.
Yeah, I think it's near impossibility that it will come down to money that Alabama is not willing to pay. I really do think, regardless of what the figure ends up being, if Texas does indeed offer him something, whatever that monetary figure is, I can't imagine any scenario where Alabama wouldn't match it. I just can't. I'm basing that on their school president saying he's the best investment the school has ever made.
Investment-wise, it wouldn't make sense.
So you let Saban, let's just say you let Saban go to Austin for a discrepancy of $1.2 million or whatever the hell it comes down to. Now you go to, let's say, my article today, and you start interviewing Kirk Ferentz or Kirby Smart or Nussmeier, another coordinator at Bama, and you start talking to Steve Spurrier and these guys. So now you bring in Steve Spurrier, who makes four or whatever he makes in South Carolina, and say, we'll give you 5.5. Now you're paying him what you just paid Saban.
Right.
And statistically, he's not the coach that Saban is.
And what does that do to your revenue from your alumni and all the rest? Yeah.
And now what does your fan base say about, well, what the hell are we doing here?
How many of you walked out Nick Saban?
You know what I mean? I mean, he was one or two plays away from competing for a third straight national championship.
Yeah. No, I know.
So, I mean, what do you want from the guy?
I don't know. I'm in the same boat. I don't think there's any chance he's going to leave. I also didn't think Robinson Cano was going to leave. But so let's not call me the great predictor here. But I just don't understand even the thought process on the other side of, like, Nick Saban, like, why he would leave. Other than the fact that some of these coaches just, like Larry Brown, like Bill Parcells, they have this thing where they just, they need to have challenges. They need to have a new challenge. I don't know how it's not a challenge. I mean, he couldn't – maybe if he won a national championship this year, I would almost think it was more so. Like, I can't do anything more. Bam, I just won 3 in a row. Like, let me go do it somewhere else and establish my legacy. Now, coming off a season where they had the ridiculously bad loss, he can't end his Alabama career like that, I don't think.
No, and the other thing is they're loaded for bear as they head into the future. I mean, there's probably fourth stringers at Bama currently that could start at probably 8 or 9 SEC schools.
Yeah.
Forget the ACC or the Big 12 or the Big 10. I mean, they could start. So Saban's got that leverage where he can look at a kid who doesn't want to play the Saban way or whatever he calls it and say, look, yeah, go sit down. I have 15 kids sitting behind you that can all play the same way you can play.
Yeah.
So he has all that. Now he goes to Texas. He's got to build from scratch, essentially. I mean, this, you know, it's an 8-win team. But it's not a very good 8-win team, and it's an 8-win team in a very weak league by all counts. So now he's going to have to go there, start over, and like we were talking about, you have a 9 or 10-win season, and they want to crucify you. It's going to be the same kind of pressure that he's under at Alabama.
Yeah.
The only difference is at Alabama he has some leeway because he can
he's got capital built up.
Yeah, take a look at my resume before you start spouting off about what an idiot I am.
Yeah, right.
You know, because you saw the deal with the Auburn, the Iron Bowl, the final play. How many questions did he really have to answer about that from the Alabama?
Yeah,
the Auburn media asked him.
Yeah, Alabama were ready. I mean, and you could put that whole thing on him. You could put this whole season on him.
Absolutely. And if he had no national championships, how would the Alabama
media have been? If he did that play as his first year as a Texas head coach,
absolutely,
it would crucify him.
If he did that against, like, Baylor or Texas or Oklahoma in the Red River Shootout, they'd kill him.
They'd kill him. It would be like all you heard about. Now, my next question about college football is, like, every year, about, you know, come November 1st, people start talking about how the BCS sucks, and there's going to be 3 or 4 undefeated teams, and so-and-so should be in. And I said on the show, I'm like, look, I don't follow college football that closely, but things always wind up working out. Last year broke down the same way, where it was like you could question the fact that Notre Dame might not be the second-best team, but they were undefeated. They beat enough teams to get there. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And so the same thing happened this way. So my question is now there's this grouping of one-loss teams. I think they got it right. I mean, if Auburn beats Alabama, how could you put Alabama ahead of them? But if you look at it the other way, I mean, Alabama's only loss is on the road to Auburn on a crazy play. And who did Auburn lose to? LSU?
LSU.
So, I mean, what's a more difficult loss, losing to Auburn at home on a crazy play or Auburn's loss to LSU? So part of me is like, of course, all things being equal, as just a general sports fan, Auburn deserves to be there. but Alabama had the second best season in college football.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you could easily make the argument that Alabama is the best team in the country. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that make the argument along with Florida State. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way it is. You know what I mean? But we're going to go to the phone line now, the Tucci Lumber Hotline, and we're going to talk to
Brandon Maller.
I'm sorry. I was not paying attention for a sec. Brandon, are you with us?
Yeah, how you guys doing?
Good, bud. Brandon is a guy who works for a Florida State website, and he follows the team very closely. We want to get into a little bit of talking about just the Auburn matchup. How do you see things matching up down there? I see it as a game of the Florida State defense versus that Auburn offense. Give us a little breakdown of what you see against the Auburn Tigers.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, I look at this one, and you know, the FSU offense gets a ton of pub and a ton of credit with Jameis Winston and the receivers and the running backs and that O-line they have. But FSU's defense has been the difference this year. There's a reason they're in the title game, and it's because of that defense. This defense has been awesome, really, since that Boston College game. That light kind of went on with Jeremy Pruitt as the new defensive coordinator this season. But, you know, this game comes down to whether or not FSU's defense is able to stop Auburn's run. And you know, the Tigers are number one in the country in rushing yards per game. We know how good they've been the last several weeks, you know, running that football with Nick Marshall and Trey Mason doing their thing. So this comes down to, you know, that defensive front for FSU, Mari Edwards Jr., Timmy Jernigan, you know, Christian Jones, those kind of guys, and then Telvin Smith at linebacker. How well do they stop Auburn's run game? And I think, all, you know, the stats kind of show, but I really do think that when this game, when you really break it down, it comes down to whether or not FSU's defense is ready to handle what will be the most potent running game they've seen all season.
Yeah, Brandon, this is Mike DePalma, and I want to ask you a follow-up question to that because, you know, all the hype is obviously around Jameis Winston, but to me, the core of this team is obviously their defense. They've been fantastic all season long, but they haven't really been tested in the fact that they haven't been in a lot of close games. I don't think anybody's going to expect this game to be a blowout. I mean, are you a little bit worried that they just don't have the resume of these close games that SEC teams seem to play? I mean, especially Auburn winning, you know, the last two games of the regular season on crazy plays. They've been tested to that point. Are you a little bit worried as an FSU fan that that having not been through those trials could be a problem in the national championship game?
You know, I think if you're really kind of trying to pick an area for this team, you know, for how good they've played all season, trying to pick that one area that does worry you, I think that is the one. I think, you know, you're a little concerned that if they have to get into a game where, you know, it's a late ball game, you need to come back late in the game and make something special happen, you know, that'd be the one area of concern. I do look at that Boston College game as being the one example this season where FSU, you know, went down early. And that game, you know, if people follow along that game, you know, until right before halftime, that game had the feeling of so many of those games in the past for FSU, that one game a year that they dropped to some lowly team that they shouldn't, you know, they have no business losing. So that game had that feeling for a while. But it was in that game where you kind of saw Jameis Winston kind of take over when the team was losing. He rallied the troops. He made that, you know, memorable play where he threw that Hail Mary pass where he broke out of a, you know, what should have been two sacks potentially and hit Kenny Shaw for the touchdown just before the half. That moment changed the game, and I think he kind of got a, you know, he kind of got a realization at that point that, okay, this kid's a, you know, he's just a redshirt freshman, but he can lead this team back if he needs to. He can be that guy that can rally these guys, can make a special play to get them back in ball games. So, you know, again, that's only one example. If it comes down to it, you kind of look at that and you think, okay, well, maybe that is, you know, kind of the one, you know, bit of experience they have. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, this whole season has been blowouts, and no game has been close. You know, Jameis Winston has not even played a whole game, really, in a couple weeks. So it'll be interesting to see. I know FSU would prefer this one to be a blow, but I know they have confidence in the leadership and in the playmakers they have that if they are losing or if it is a close game, you know, they can kind of ride on these guys.
Yeah, Brandon, you know what, it's interesting to me, being up in the Northeast, obviously we're not college football guys, we're Mets, you know, Jets, Nets, you know, we're big professional sports team fans up here. I'm lucky enough to be a co-host with Danny Santarella, who's a big college football fan. He really covers my ass a lot with just with callers and all, because I'm not a guy who follows it day by day, but my father's a transplant down to Florida, and he's like, it's amazing to him, like, you know, he lives up in North Florida in Palm Coast, and he says, you know, on Saturdays, I mean, it's just, people put their Florida flags out there, you know, and nobody could talk, you know, you can't talk to people about major leagues or the Mets or the Yankees or anything like that. So it's really an environment that I have a hard time relating to. Now, you're a guy, you obviously you run Seminoles.com, you've got the Doak Insider blog, so you're clearly a gung-ho FSU guy, FSU graduate, you got a couple degrees from there. So walk me through being a fan of a season like this. Obviously, you had high expectations, but as the season unfolded, at what point, was it that coming out moment week one when Jameis Winston was really introduced to the country that you knew you had something special? Or being as intimate with the team as you are, did you know in spring football that this team was going to be legit and they had national championship hopes?
Well, hey, I'll say as somebody who has been around the program and has been inside the program and was at every practice in the spring and at every practice in fall camp, I'll admit it. I'll say that, you know, I didn't think that this team necessarily had, you know, or was ready to win a national championship this year or even compete for one. I looked at that Clemson game on the road. I looked at that Florida game on the road as being, you know, probably the two games where this team would have L's in the loss column. Because, you know, you just looked at those teams. You looked at Clemson with Taj Boyd and Sammy Watkins, and you knew their defense was going to be better. You figured, you know, that team was maybe more set up to be successful in that game. And then Florida, you know, before all the injuries happened, you kind of assumed, you know, going down to Gainesville, playing on the road with a team that, you know, should have had the number one defense in the country. You kind of looked at those games as being the ones where it just set up nicely for those teams. But I'll tell you, you know, Jameis Winston came out. You know, it was not a runaway victory for him in fall camp. He had to earn every snap he got in fall camp. He had to beat out Jacob Hooker, and I think a lot of people don't realize that. I think a lot of people think that it was just his job from the day one. Jacob Hooker is a legit quarterback, and he had to beat him out, and I think that helped him, obviously. But that Pittsburgh game obviously was huge. You kind of got the feeling that, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. But I'll tell you, down here in Tallahassee, everybody who's run the program, that Clemson game was the official moment when everyone was like, whoa, wait a second. This team legitimately has national championship, you know, potential. And it speaks volumes to Jameis Winston as a player. It speaks to all the players on this team. And you've got to give Jimbo Fisher credit. He had to replace six assistant coaches in the offseason, and that kind of led to some of the doubts people had this season. How can six new coaches come in? How can these guys all, you know, kind of have one same common goal? How can not be any growing pains here or there? But it really has worked out nicely. And yeah, like I said, that Clemson game was kind of the jumping-off point. And it's really kind of been an easy ride ever since.
Yeah, Brandon, before I ask you about a couple questions about Jimbo Fisher, do you think this Auburn offense with Nick Marshall, Trey Mason, you know, they have Sammy Coates on the outside, they have a lot of weapons, is the closest thing this Florida State defense has seen to this type of attack, this spread attack, is it that Clemson game? And is that something that Florida State fans are kind of thinking, hey, you know, Auburn's going to be a similar team to them from a talent standpoint, or do you guys see it the way I kind of see it, which is Auburn's a step above Clemson?
Yeah, I think people appreciate Auburn for what they are. I think they know that they're a step ahead of Clemson. I think, you know, and I'll say this, I think Taj Boyd is a better quarterback than Nick Marshall is as a passer. But when you get that guy running, I mean, this is a kid who grew up watching, you know, and idolizing Charlie Ward. I followed him in his recruitment. I knew all about him coming out of high school. I knew he could be something special. And he has modeled his game after Charlie Ward. So I think FSU fans truly appreciate how good Nick Marshall can be as a runner. Trey Mason is obviously, you know, one of the best players that FSU will face, you know, kind of pound for pound on the offensive side of the ball. You know, Andre Williams at Boston College, he's a Heisman finalist like Jameis Winston. He put up a ton of yards against the Noles earlier this season. So they have seen an elite running back like that. But I think the whole package that Auburn has to offer offensively is without a doubt the biggest, you know, the biggest task for this FSU defense. But, you know, I think FSU has an added advantage. They got Jeremy Pruitt, who was at Alabama. He coached against Gus Malzahn when he was at Alabama, when Malzahn was there before under Gene Chizik. So he has some experience scheming for an offense like this Auburn attack, but it certainly is going to be the biggest challenge of the season for the Noles.
Yeah, Brandon, I agree with you. And to get back to Coach Fisher, I wrote an article for a website where I said that he would be my coach of the year. I'm sure you hear a lot more about how good he is down there. But up here, I've made mention that I don't hear a lot about him. I hear a lot about Art Briles and David Cutcliffe, Urban Meyer. I hear a lot of different conversations, but for what Fisher has done with that program at the end of Bowden's legacy, where they had some of those 7-win seasons, they were losing some on the recruiting trails. Talk a little bit about just how good this guy has been, because I don't hear enough of it up here.
Yeah, Jimbo Fisher, you know, in my mind as the coach of the year. And you know, I get it. I understand why he doesn't win some of these awards, because a lot of times you kind of shy away. You know, some of these voters for these things, they kind of shy away from guys that have elite talent. And FSU has as good a talent as anybody in the country. You look up and down that roster, and you got a bunch of NFL players who are playing for this team. But, you know, that shouldn't take away from what Fisher has done. I think he deserves a ton of credit for not only being the head coach and being a guy who's an ace recruiter and probably one of the better head coach recruiters out there, but he's also a guy who's able to be the head coach, and he's the play caller. He's calling plays. He's the offensive coordinator. You know, that was kind of a whole thing in the offseason when James Coley left FSU for Miami to be the Hurricanes offensive coordinator. People are like, okay, well, what are you going to do? You're going to bring in an OC? You're going to bring in some elite play caller who's going to help you? And he said, no way, I'm doing this thing. And I think people kind of doubted that he could be a guy who could run the program and who could call plays. But we saw this season, he's had no difficulty, you know, kind of running the ship and, you know, calling these plays as well, too. So he deserves a ton of credit for that. And, again, the biggest thing, as I said before, guy lost six assistant coaches. All of them went on to bigger and better jobs. Mark Stoops, the head coach of Kentucky. DJ Elliott, the DN's coach, went to be D coordinator at Kentucky. Eddie Grant, from running backs coach to offensive coordinator at Cincinnati. Greg Hudson was the linebackers coach, took the DC job at Purdue. He lost all these guys. Yet somehow it feels like, and I think you can make the argument, he's got a better coaching staff now than he ever has. So he lost a lot of guys, but he was able to go out and get a bunch of guys to come on board and wanted to coach with him. And I think the biggest thing was he picked guys who kind of share his same kind of sense of values and same kind of sense of the way he wants the program to run. So he deserves a ton of credit. This hasn't just been something that happened overnight. He's built this thing. And this senior class that's leading this program is his first senior class that signed with him. These are kids that deserve credit, too. LaMarcus Joyner, Christian Jones, Telvin Smith, they all signed on with Jimbo Fisher when this program was in disarray after Bowden left. So, again, from top to bottom, Jimbo Fisher deserves a ton of credit.
Yeah, you know, Brandon, I don't think nationally, as a guy up in the Northeast, I don't think Jimbo Fisher gets nearly enough credit for what he's done with that program. I mean, taking over for a legend like Bobby Bowden, after, you know, some down times there at FSU, as great as the program's been, taking over and then immediately turning things around quickly and then putting them in position for a national championship so quickly. I mean, look, the guy's a Division III guy. I play Division III baseball, so I have a lot of, like, affinity for those guys that come out of the struggle and make it, so I like it. But, I mean, I just, you know, you hear all these talk about all these other college coaches up here, and I just don't hear the love for them. And my co-host here wrote a great article, like he said, about it. But, I mean, what do you think that is? I mean, I think people just assume taking over for a great program, it's a given. Like, oh, he got an easy gig. But he took over in a very tough time and did more than I think a lot of people thought he would.
Yeah, he did. And he took over, too, when Florida had that thing rolling. When Urban Meyer had the train rolling down in Gainesville, he took over. FSU was getting killed on the recruiting trail. You know, a couple of 7-6 seasons really, you know, really knocked this program down a peg and really has people concerned with the long-term, you know, kind of longevity of FSU and what it could be in the future and if it could ever return. And, you know, for Jimbo Fisher, you know, this is a guy who grew up an FSU fan. I mean, there's photos of him playing college ball, and he's wearing an FSU hat on the sideline. So he grew up, you know, kind of following FSU, idolizing the Bowden family, coach for Terry Bowden at Auburn as a quarterbacks coach before getting the job with Saban and LSU. So he understood the history of FSU, and I don't know. I don't know what it is nationally why he doesn't get a ton of credit. Maybe it's because he talks really fast. He's got that thick, you know, that thick Southern drawl. I don't know if he's a great quote always. Maybe it's harder to transcribe. I'm not sure what it is, but I think he kind of likes it. I think he kind of likes being that guy that people aren't talking about and prefers to kind of fly under the radar. But he's not going to be able to do that much longer if he keeps FSU in the hunt for national titles.
Brandon, just to ask one question about Jameis Winston. I don't want to get into too much of his legal issues or anything like that, but did you think some of his performance were really in that ACC championship game? He looked like a freshman really for the first time that I saw. Do you think that his mind was kind of split between what he was going through off the field and in the game, or was it something Duke maybe did schematically on defense? Or was that just an anomaly, or is that something maybe people are a little worried about down in Tallahassee heading into the Auburn game?
Yeah, no, I'll say two things. I'll say, one, Duke deserves a ton of credit, and they're not going to get it because they're Duke, but that was probably one of the better coach teams I've seen FSU play this season. That defense deserves a ton of credit for what they did. They've got some really good players on that side of the ball. And then second, yeah, I mean, I don't – I'm not in Jameis's head. I don't know what he was thinking or what was going on with him, but you're right. He didn't look as good as he has all season, and I don't know if that was just a combination of everything that had been going on. I mean, I don't know what that's like to be in that situation. I don't know what that's like to kind of have something like that, you know, kind of staring at me face-to-face and not knowing what the future may hold. So, again, I can't speak for him on that, but he definitely didn't look the same. Again, you know, I'm kind of following along. He's down in Orlando tonight for the College Football Awards that air tomorrow on ESPN. He is that same lovable, smiling, likable guy that he's always been. So I think for whatever it was or whatever may have been, you know, kind of bugging him a little bit in that game, maybe it didn't make him look as good as he's been all season. I'm sure that will not be an issue come January 2nd or January 6th, excuse me.
All right, Brandon, we really appreciate you coming on. Now, up in the Northeast, this is really the time when we start paying attention to college football, other than my co-host here who's a dork about college football. But, you know, we got UConn, we got Rutgers, they stink. So this is the time where people are going to start doing their research for their bowl betting. So I want to make sure I get your plug right. It's Seminoles.com if guys want to go and research and go back through some of your old blogs and all. Seminoles.com, is that the place to find you?
Yeah, come find me on Seminoles.com or on Twitter at Brandon Mellor. That's M-E-L-L-O-R. Check us out there. I mean, we're the official site of FSU. So we're kind of in the mix with the team every step of the way. We're on the team playing out to Pasadena. We're with them, you know, a week early going out there to get everything going out in California. So, you know, definitely stick with us. There's a ton of great sites you can get FSU coverage, but we're the only ones from the inside. So I encourage all FSU fans to come check us out.
We definitely will. We'll push as many of our fans towards your site as possible, and we really do appreciate your time on a Wednesday night. I know it'll be a long month for you waiting up for the big show, but it'll be fun, and I really, you know, I'm really glad for you guys. They're a likable team. You know, Jameis Winston with his, you know, handshakes with the coach's son and all that. It's a very likable team. It's easy to get behind you guys, so I'll be pulling for you. And forget Auburn. I'm not rooting for Auburn. So we really, really appreciate your time, Brandon, all right?
All right, thanks, guys. I appreciate having me on, and I'll come on anytime you need me.
I really appreciate it. There you go. I mean, that's a good guy right there. That guy gave more insight in 15 minutes than you, Mr. College Football Guy, could have given me in 15 years.
Yeah, plus he had to deal with me at the beginning of that interview.
Mod, oh, what happened to you?
I was in the middle of, what was I talking about?
Who knows what you were talking about?
I didn't
about.
Know where I was.
You didn't know. You looked at me.
That was terrible.
You were ready to go to the call. You looked at me like maybe you were hoping Ernie Banks' voice would just chime in.
I just
in.
Wanted you to hit me.
I think if Ernie Banks was listening right now, he would take back his statement.
He would
look at that and be like, I mean, take it back. Can I give? Maybe we could play that just to get you back on court, back on track, cheer you up a little bit.
I always
Dan is a great guy. You all should put a statue of him right out in front of that station. Dan is a remarkable person because he grew up with the Cubs.
It's true.
I mean, sometimes when you're feeling down, like something maybe didn't go your way, you just listen to that. He said you were a remarkable person. I forget how great that is because I haven't played it in a couple weeks.
I think
Ernie Banks just said you were a remarkable person.
I think while I was...
Nobody's ever said I'm a remarkable person.
You say it about yourself.
Well, I tell my wife all the time.
I think if we could have played that at the top of the Brandon Mellor interview, it would have gone a lot better. He could have understood, hey, he's got some cachet. Ernie Banks likes this guy. But I do. I apologize to Brandon. I was looking forward to that interview. It was a good interview. I enjoyed talking with him.
No, it was good.
But I was a little clownish at the beginning. That was
like
very
that.
Unprofessional. And I'm disappointed in myself. And you know what's scary is I'm stone cold sober.
I know. That is scary.
Really
that's upsetting. The problem.
It's really upsetting.
You know, I saw an article that was circulating on Facebook today that there was a legitimate study done that said that moderate drinkers live far longer than non-drinkers.
You know the key word in that sentence?
Moderate. Well, I got to get you the thing. I think it even said like heavy drinkers might surpass the non-drinkers because it's a social, it's like a social lubricant. So you feel better about yourself. I know that it said that people that don't drink have a much higher depression rate than the drinkers.
Well, I find oftentimes that the alcohol holds my hand on the way to depression.
I'm just going with science.
Yeah, you're going with science?
I'm going with science, my man.
What are the metrics on this?
I got to check it out. I don't know.
What's my war? Is it
What's the sabermetrics on Danny's drinking? I don't know. My wins over replacement on bourbon and lemonades is skyrocketing. I'm the Mike Trout of bourbon and lemonades.
You're tremendous. You're
I'll tell you that right now.
Fantastic person.
All right, before we go to a break, I got
it.
One last question.
Yeah.
Have you gone through the bowl schedule? I mean, have you taken a look at it?
I have.
Now, my question to you is this. Obviously, everybody's going to be watching the BCS games.
Mm-hmm.
As a guy like me, give me one bowl game. I'm quizzing you now.
Yeah.
One game... That might, like, jump out at you.
And I got it.
You do have it.
I do have it. Number one,
I
just
going to stump you. No, Sober Dan, you can't stump Sober Dan.
Number one, just for a brief BCS game, the one I'm most excited for other than Auburn FSU is Michigan State Stanford in the Rose Bowl. That's old school football. If you like I formations, downhill
it's,
running,
I saw
smash
that too,
mouth football.
Because I looked at making my picks, I'm like, I don't know how to pick that game.
Yeah, but I'm going to give you this one. I'm going to give you the Liberty Bowl, Mississippi State and Rice. And a lot of people are going to say,
What? I'm saying it. Rice football?
David Bailiff, the head coach at Rice.
The idea that you know, and on the cuff, like you didn't. I didn't ask you like you knew you were going to prepare for this.
No.
You just know Rice's football coach, his head coach.
David Bailiff is a really good football coach, and that's a really, really tough place to win, even more so than the other really tough academic institutions. Rice is extremely difficult because look where Rice is.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking in the heart of Texas, in Houston, competing against those schools on the recruiting trails and everything. They're 10-3. They're Conference USA champs.
Yeah.
They're going up against the 6-6 Mississippi State team that's 3-5 in the SEC, and they're favored. Mississippi State.
Yeah, because everybody's going to say SEC no matter what.
But
there's no way an SEC team's going to lose to Rice, in my mind, if I look at that. I don't care what Rice's record is.
And the interesting thing about Rice this year is they get blown out by Johnny Manziel and A&M. That was the game where Johnny had to sit out the first half, and he was doing the money
thing. He was doing the money thing. That's the only reason I know Rice. Right. That's what I'm saying. I didn't even know that they were that good. They turned out to be 10-3.
Right, 10-3. They blew out Marshall in the Conference USA game, championship game, which I watched. And it's a team that has a 2,600-yard passer, a 900-yard rusher, some really good receivers, a good defense. They're small, but they play really hard. And Bailiff seems to have game plans for everybody. And I'm interested to see that game because you're asking for an off-the-beaten-path game.
Some game I want to watch, yeah.
I want to see how Rice plays.
I would love for Rice to be an SEC team. Would love it.
It would be great. Here's the thing about a 6-6 SEC team, a 3-5 in-conference SEC team. There's a very good chance you just flip that record in any other league. Mississippi State's a good team. Dan Mullen's a good coach. I'm really interested to see there. I think there's a touchdown underdog, 6 or 7.
Yeah, we could check it out.
I'm curious to see David Bailiff's game planning. I think that's a New Year's Eve game, or it might be December 30th. That's the game that jumped out to me. I mean, I love watching Navy when they're in a bowl or whatever. But Rice, I'm curious to see a 10-3 Rice school team against a 6-6 SEC club.
That is very – see, that's good. I should have even prepped you because when I first started asking, I'm like, man, I'm going to stump this guy. But no, you already did your research.
Yeah.
You knew how many yards the freaking quarterback threw for at Rice.
Yeah.
And you call some of our listeners dorks, and you just know random stats. You're a stats guy.
I'm a stats guy. And, but another one I can give you real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
People out there, because I know they have a huge following.
Where's UConn playing this year? They make it into a bowl?
I don't even think they made a bowl game.
Well, they had won one game, so yeah. I don't know.
Notre Dame Rutgers, Pinstripe Bowl, Yankee Stadium. Interesting for a lot of reasons.
Notre Dame.
Daniel Nava, not
Lay
Daniel Nava. Gary Nova, the
pipe.
Quarterback.
Yeah.
Notre Dame, everybody follows them.
Yeah.
Everybody loves to either root for them or root against them.
Everybody in the world's going to be betting on Notre Dame.
I just called Rutgers quarterback a Red Sox outfielder.
Yeah, you did call him Danny Nava. I said,
not Gary Nova.
I didn't know he had eligibility. Like
Daniel Nava.
He slings it all over the place.
He absolutely does.
All right, let's take a quick commercial break. We're going to come back. We'll maybe talk a little baseball.
Let's do it.
So I could get involved in the show.
You were involved. You just talked to a Florida State guy and pretended you
was
my
boy.
It was awesome.
I broke it down,
it was
dude.
Awesome.
All right, we'll be right back with the Tri-State Sports Guys.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Golf Tournament Quiet Sign Holder Upper.
Mr. Golf Tournament Quiet Sign Holder Upper.
Boldly you patrol the line between order and anarchy. Armed with only your wits, your resolve, and your tiny cardboard sign stapled to a stick.
Actually, I glued it on.
You protect professional golfers from what they fear most. Idle chit-chat 200 yards away.
Stop breathing so loud now.
Because you know there's one thing this spectator sport could really do without. Spectators.
Get them out.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, oh Sultan of the Shush. We'll keep singing your praises as long as you keep telling us to shut up.
Mr. Golf Cinnamon Quiet Sign Holder Upper.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys. Check us out as always. TriStateSportsGuys.com, Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys, and at TriState_Sports. Thanks again to Brandon Miller for coming on from Seminoles.com. Check his stuff out down there as you're getting ready for your national championship bets. Thanks again for Tad Boyle. He was really good, I thought. earlier on in the show.
He was great.
And, you know, we got another guest coming up a little later on. But I want to talk a little bit about baseball before we get too far off topic here.
Yeah.
This is a baseball town. Because the two basketball teams stink. Although the Nets are starting to make some moves. Two in a row.
Paul Pierce is back.
You got Paul Pierce. He's now in the sixth. Let's talk about the basketball real quick.
Okay.
Because now Paul Pierce, he was the sixth man last night because he was first game back, which is all fine and good. But Jason Kidd is talking about just making him permanently the sixth man. And I actually think that's a really good idea. Because they do have a decent bench. But there seems to be not like, you know, you get like Sean Livingston comes in there. Or, you get a whole wave of guys. You know, for whatever reason, Jason Kidd just hates Reggie Evans. He never plays, even though the guy will average 15 rebounds a game if you gave him 20 minutes. But
Iowa Hawkeye.
I love him to death.
Mm-hmm. You should. Play
love
the game
him
the right way.
To death.
Yep.
My favorite net right now.
I don't blame you.
But I think they need that sort of, like, field general when some of these subs are coming in, one of the, you know, the guys come off the bench. I kind of like it. I think, you know, I think he had 7 assists last night in, like, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So I don't mind that. And then Darren Williams comes back, finally, and actually does very well. And you know my hatred of Darren Williams as a Nets fan, which I know it surprises people, but people don't watch the Nets like I watch the Nets, apparently, because if you watch them, you would know he typically wilts in big games. And let's not call a game against the Celtics a big game. There's no doubt in my mind he's going to drop 25 against the Celtics. Let's see what he does in a big game when they play the Heat, play somebody else like that. But do you think at this point, the Nets are the team that could turn things around in that division. I mean, right now, none of the teams are over 500. They're only 2 games out first, as bad as they've been at 7-14.
I don't think there's any question when you
they're
going to
be
it.
The team that's going to make the play. They're going to make the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean,
all this panic, they're going to make the playoffs.
Honestly, I wouldn't make this argument, but you can make an argument that the Knicks could win that division. I mean, it's a terrible division. What were they like the other day when I watched the Nets Knicks game? They were 2.5 out of first. They're like 5-13.
Yeah.
The deal with Pierce coming off the bench. I understand basketball. I played it. I wasn't very good. If I played it in Hawkeye, I would have never even been on the team.
No, you can't get any burn at the whack.
But I'll never argue with anything Red Auerbach or John Wooden has to say. And when Red Auerbach kind of created that six-man, he used John Havlicek, Hall of Famer. Havlicek and Pierce are very similar players when you look at them. They're both very similar skill sets. And John Wooden gave all the credit in the world to Red Auerbach for that. Boy, having one of your best players, maybe your best perimeter player, whatever you want to call Havlicek, come off the bench, is brilliant. So you're the Nets, you're scuffling, and you go to a guy like Paul Pierce as your first option off the bench? How can you go wrong?
No, I mean, teams have done it. I mean, remember Ben Gordon was a guy that always came off the bench and did very well. Obviously, you saw J.R. Smith. If you watched the Knicks last year, you say, why is J.R. Smith not starting? Well, if a guy fits into that role, Jamal Crawford is another guy. You know, there are some guys.
How about this one? Vinny the Microwave Johnson.
Well, Vinny Johnson.
Remember Vinny?
Oh, of course I remember Vinny. That was when I was like really into
I used to love
basketball
the NBA
back then, you know what I mean? But if you do want to check us out, you want to call in and give your thoughts, the line is 347-637-2306. We got a couple callers on hold. We're going to go out to line number one. You are on with the Tri-State Sports Guys, Mike and Dan. Who's this?
Hi, Mike.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Paul in Brantford. How are you guys doing? And I called him last week.
Yeah, Paulie from Brantford. How you doing, buddy?
doing good. And I think I was on the website, and I think that I'm the other Kansas Jayhawk fan in the state of Connecticut. So I was.
You
I was
are. This is when I said you call in. I'm going to go have myself a drink, and you and Dan can sit there and tell me how great Kansas basketball is. How heartbreaking was this weekend for you, brother?
I don't think they're that great right now, so that's why I was calling in to cry a little bit.
Cry away, buddy. I'll cry right along with you. What are your thoughts? Give them to me. I'll tell you how sick I am when you get done.
Well, I mean, I'm not all that down about it. Because it's such a young team. It's a bunch of freshmen that are trying to learn to play together, and the team right now, the chemistry, kind of reminds me of that 2006 UConn team that lost to George Mason. They had all these stars on the team, but they just couldn't play well together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just I think that one of the problems with, with Bill Self, we have the high-low game, and we really don't have that power presence that we've had in the paint all these last 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, we had the Morris twins. You had Thomas Robinson, who led us to the championship game. We've had Jeff Withey. And we just really don't have that dominant presence down low right now. I know Joel Embiid is, supposed to be an NBA prospect, but he just looks so raw. So we just really didn't have that talent down low that we've always sort of had, in that dominant defender, that dominant shot blocker that we've just been so used to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I agree with a lot of what you said, Paul. I could make the argument, in all honesty, that Perry Ellis' post game as a sophomore is far more advanced than either of the Morris brothers or Thomas Robinson. And I would only say that because he can play with his back to the basket. He can face up. He's got range out to about 18, 19 feet. The problem with Perry Ellis, as good as he is, and he may be the best interior player in the entire Big 12, is Bill Self doesn't have any kind of way to get him the basketball. I mean, if Villanova running a lineup with your biggest guy 6'5", and you can't get the ball into a 6'9" Perry Ellis, the problem is a lot bigger than Perry Ellis's lack of perceived lack of post moves. I mean, he has the entire package. They can't get him the ball. You look at last night, they got their tails pressed off once again, which I expected with Florida and Billy Donovan. They sent Wiggins right through the middle of the press one time. They broke it. They got a bucket, and they never did it again. So, I mean, you have a whole litany of problems as I see the team right now, and I know that they're young. But to say that we don't have a post guy, I think you know as well as I do, Ellis is a very, very good post player. They just
have done
a really poor job of getting him the ball. Wouldn't you agree with that, at least to some extent?
Well, I was not – I mean, I'm not really thinking about it, and you're talking about his offensive game, which I think he's got a very diverse and a really good, you know, offensive game. I would more lean in towards, you know, the physicality that we used to have down low, where people just couldn't really attack the basket and attack the rim. And it just seems like we have a lot of problems being able to do that. It's, you know, our strength is on the wings right now, and, you know, two freshmen and even our point guards. I mean, Azir Tharp is not doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's been getting benched. So it's, you know, between the point guard play and the defensive post play, you know, I mean, obviously we have Wiggins, we have the guys that are the flashy kind of, you know, highlight reel type of guys, but we don't have those lunch pail guys, it seems like. Just the guys that come down and make the assists, like you said, get the ball down low and all that. You know, it's just the chemistry is not there. We didn't have a point guard last year. I mean, just look at what happened against Michigan with Elijah Johnson, and Elijah Johnson was just like in and out of the lineup, and it's just, you know, I know we're getting really esoteric here. We're talking about Kansas basketball, but since you had the guy on from Colorado tonight, I figured I'd call in and talk about it.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. Frank Mason, to me, has been the guy to be the point guard since the very beginning, since the UL Monroe game that Tharp had to sit because of an NCAA violation of some kind. Frank Mason, the team looks different when he's running the show. I think, to what you're getting at, I think Embiid eventually can be that Thomas Robinson, Jeff Withey type of shot eraser. And I think Traylor and Tarik Black are the lunch pail guys, as you rightfully referred to it. But I think it is going to be a matter of them getting a little bit of chemistry, growing a little bit together. But I think we're going to be all right. And, you know, we do appreciate the call, Paul. You call in any time. We're getting a little bit of baseball, so listen in and call us back any time. But we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, bud.
All right, Danny.
Go ahead.
You done? I mean, this is like your thing. I mean, it was a very good call. You guys broke things down.
Yeah.
But it was like right as I started to like maybe have some sort of say in this show today.
Maybe that's a sign.
You just happened to take a call about Kansas basketball. Like, we haven't talked enough about Kansas basketball today.
Yeah.
We have to jump into a quick call. Can we talk about my New York Mets right
now?
Let's
talk about it. You're wearing an orange T-shirt, so I know you're
because excited. Because of the Bartolo Colon signing. Now, there's so many things that have happened in the last week in baseball. There's the Trumbo trade, obviously, which I thought was kind of one of those trades that kind of works for everybody. I think Trumbo will be very good out in Arizona. The ball carries well out there.
That's a nice lineup there now.
Yeah, now all of a sudden, they got Goldschmidt. Aaron Hill still got a lot of pop.
Yep.
They got some talent out there. They were my sleeper team last year, and they looked very good through the middle of July and then fell on their face.
Did you see how stoked Adam Eaton was to go to the White Sox? Did you read his Twitter thing?
No.
I read it in the paper yesterday.
Adam Eaton wanted to go to Chicago.
Dude, I think it was Twitter. Don't quote me on that. But I think he was on Twitter going, yeah, it had to be because he said hashtag AL Central Champs, and he's so excited to play for like an original team and all that. And I was like,
the original six?
Nobody should be that excited to go to Chicago.
I'll tell you what about Adam Eaton, and you're not a fantasy guy, but he was one of those guys like last year that this guy's going to hit 320, his on base is going to be 400, he just finds a way to get hits. And he was like a 50th round draft pick, like one of those guys, just like a grinder, a very guy, like a guy that fantasy nerds loved. Then he got hurt.
Yep.
It was either end of spring training or early in the season. I think it was end of spring training. So he didn't start playing until, you know, August or whatever. Never really got his feet on the ground. But he's a big time prospect, so that makes sense for them. Who'd they give up? Quintana, I think.
Yeah.
It's one of those deals, those three team deals that kind of make sense for everybody.
Was it Santiago or Quintana?
I don't know. We got to look it up. It was a decent pitcher. So basically the Angels added two starters.
I think is huge, right?
Yeah, exactly, because that's what they needed.
Yeah.
That's absolutely what they needed as a team that used to be based on starting pitching. Last year when Weaver was not healthy, they were nothing. I mean, they couldn't win games. They don't just matter. I mean, their offense struggled, but it didn't matter. They weren't going to pitch well enough. So I think it's one of those games. I find it weird that they were so eager to shop Trumbo. A little weird because, I mean, the guy did drop 34 bombs, whatever, 30-something home runs, 100 RBIs. He can't – I mean, his average is going to be below 250, but he's got pop. So I think it kind of fits with what Arizona wants to do. Their home run hitting team, Goldschmidt's a stud. Aaron Hill's got pop, like I said. They got the Didi Gregorius guy.
What about the fact now they're going to have to play him in the outfield?
Yeah, left fielder. He's played outfield, though.
But doesn't on some level National League team making that deal, is it a little – I mean, I know I was always told growing up, if you could hit, you'll play.
Yeah.
So I understand. I understand you're going to play him.
Yeah.
But doesn't that hurt
the team
a little bit?
I just can't wait to see him playing however many games they play against Colorado in Colorado in that big-ass outfield.
Yeah, and that outfield...
Cruising around the outfield.
That Chase Field outfield?
Yeah.
Left field line, that huge, big, high wall in center field, that's not short.
Yeah, no.
That's a lot of ground.
He's
got
to cover some ground.
Yeah.
He seems pretty athletic. He doesn't seem like a lumbering Lucas Duda type guy. He's a big guy. He seems relatively athletic because he's been able to bounce around third base, first base. You know, for a guy who's big like that, he's got a lot of versatility. There's not a lot of guys that could do what he's done.
Why are we out in Arizona when we want to talk about Bartolo Colon? I want to hear you explain it to me right now how excited you are.
I'll tell you right now, my excitement level for the Bartolo Colon signing is about a 6.
A 6. Just on a 10 scale, not 100?
Yeah.
10 scale.
So it's about a 6 out of 10. So I know people seem to be way more excited than I am, and people want to point to how great his season was last year. A, you pitch in Oakland, foul territory is about 3 miles on each line.
3.5.
You're gonna have a low ERA. Like when they had all those guys, you know, the Mulder, Zito, and all those guys. It's easy to have a low ERA. I mean, you've played high school baseball. The fields that had infinite foul territory, where it was like you could just go catch anything, it eats up a lot of hits.
Yeah,
it really does. You look at like Citi Field where it's tight down the line, you know, that line, it hugs, you're not going to get all those. And you talk about, you watch him pitch, you know, he's a veteran pitcher, he knows what he's doing, he's going to give you innings. I would rather have seen Bronson Arroyo. I know Bronson Arroyo you probably had to give a third year to, but I would have rather seen that. I think he's got better stuff than Bartolo Colon does at this point in his career. Look, Bartolo Colon's a solid pitcher. But there's going to be a point, like I said earlier in the show, where he breaks down, and it's going to take place in the orange and blue, and I don't want to see that. And my point is, they spend $10 million this upcoming season on Bartolo Colon. They're going to spend $7 million on Chris Young. And even though I predicted the Chris Young signing, it doesn't make it a good signing. I just thought that was what, knowing the Mets, and I said that in my article, this is the type of signing they're going to do. And it made sense. They're going to go out and say, let's take a flyer on a guy. Would I rather have taken that $17 million and gone out and added something better than Bartolo Colon and Chris Young? Yeah. And then you look at the $15 million or whatever they're paying to Curtis Granderson. I'm not a huge fan of the Curtis Granderson signing, even though, as you know, we were the first ones to break that story from our sources.
Absolutely.
A day earlier.
Like
but nobody gives us any credit.
No.
Nobody said Tri-State Sports guys are reporting.
No.
Even though we broke it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a legitimate break.
So here's what I want to know. We kind of got into this a week or two ago. We've both come to the conclusion that the Cubs and Mets are in similar situations, but different. And I said, I expect the Cubs to be, you know, at best like a 70-win team. And you said, well, you know, now the Mets should be 500, right?
Yeah.
That's what you said. Doesn't Colon, if he's healthy, get you to that end? Doesn't he help? I'm not get you to it, but doesn't he help?
Well, here's
isn't that the goal for like the Mets fans right now? Is we want to be 81-81 or around there?
You want to get to that point, but here's what I'm thinking as far as last year they won 74 games.
Right.
Right. They don't have Matt Harvey this year.
Yep.
They're essentially replacing Matt Harvey with Bartolo Colon, which you're going to say is going to be a step back.
Yes.
Right? They signed Curtis Granish, who's a nice signing. He's going to be a better ball player than that. But they're basically replacing Marlon Byrd, who they had when they got all their wins, with Curtis Granish. With what Marlon Byrd gave them last year, is Curtis Granish going to give you that much more? He gave them 20 home runs as a Met. If Curtis Granson gives you 25 home runs, I would be pretty happy with that.
Well, I'm curious to see him get there. We talked about Chu, and I said how, I think to some extent the Great American Ballpark helped him, and you said, he did the same thing in Cleveland, and you're right.
And he did. He's not.
Granderson was hitting just seeds at Yankee Stadium. Yeah. Now, I mean, most decent left-handed hitters, which Granderson's a good left-handed hitter. What does he do now at Citi Field? I mean, doesn't it – it has to knock his numbers down.
You would hope, though, that he reverts back to his numbers
– In Detroit. Right.
Where he had 130 home run season. He was more of a 25 home run. He's not going to be a 25 steal guy anymore. I think he had, in the teens last year. He's not going to be that type of guy. But a gap-to-gap guy. I think he did – and people say you don't change your swing. Clearly, if you – anybody that knows baseball has – can watch Mark Teixeira and tell you that guy changed his swing since he moved to Yankee Stadium.
Right.
I think that Curtis Granson did the same. He worked with Mark Long. What's his name? Mark Long?
Kevin
Long, the hitting coach. And all of a sudden now he was very good against left-handed pitching, which he was.
Yep.
He was there platooning him when he got there. And then he wound up leading the league in home runs versus lefties as a lefty, which is hard to do. But I think that they tweaked. I think that Kevin Long is a very good hitting coach because you could see them make adjustments, and he made adjustments. But I think that his swing is definitely different. He's going to strike out a lot no matter what. But I think that hopefully he knows. He seems like an intelligent baseball player. He could revert back to being the gap-to-gap guy, and he can now instead of giving you 40 home runs, he can give you 25 home runs but 10 triples. This is the type of player you want him to be. I don't know if he's going to do it, but your original question about them being 500, if you look at the team they were putting out last year, what did they add? They basically replaced Marlon Byrd with Curtis Granderson from last year's
right.
lineup, and they replaced Matt Harvey with Bartolo Colon.
Yeah,
my point, those are two washes. So
yeah.
How are they going to win 81 games?
I don't know. All I'm saying is what I was kind of getting at is as a Cubs fan, if the Cubs added Colon, who I wouldn't want for obvious reasons, because I'm not a fan of those guys that have done some of those things, but if they got him, I would go, you know what? You know what he really is? He's a guy who's an established veteran. He throws strikes.
He's Mark Traxel.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, for a Cubs fan, I would look at it like I said about the Ellsbury thing. I would never want them to pay that much money, but I would look at it like, you know what it is for a team that's going to stink like a dog's behind? It's a player I can watch that I like. I see Granderson that way because I love the way he plays.
I like Curtis Granderson a lot, yeah.
We were talking the other day about just because players, guys who like just because.
Reggie Evans is one would be the
absolutely.
Top of my list.
Even if I didn't see Granderson's statistics, I would go, you know what, just watching him. Love the way he busted out of the box. Love the way he dives around the outfield.
Yeah,
if
got
I'm
no
a
arm.
Met fan, I'm excited. I go, you know what, this is a guy, and I still would have loved to have seen Dendecker, Lagares, whatever young guys you're going to go with, because I think that's what the Mets are.
Yeah. Well, I think now the thing is, the real question at this point is, are the Mets going to add anyone else? And at this point, you're looking at a couple things. Are they going to trade Daniel Murphy? Which to me really doesn't make sense because Daniel Murphy, David Wright aside, who's clearly the face of their franchise, the only consistent hitter they've had over the last couple of years is Daniel Murphy.
I love him.
Just a professional hitter.
Love him.
You know what I mean? Like, gets big hits when you need them.
When's he not dirty?
Yeah, just gives you and everybody wants to crap on him for his second base play. He actually plays a solid second base.
Yeah.
I don't care what you say. He a ball's hit to him, he makes the play. He doesn't make a ton of errors. Let's not pretend he's Chuck Knobloch or somebody like that. This guy makes the plays that are hit to him. He's not Robinson Cano or Brandon Phillips or all that. So it just surprises me that he's the guy they're dangling out there. Now, the reports out today are his asking price is very high. The Orioles came to them and said, yeah, we're interested, and they wanted Dylan Bundy, who is their prized possession. So I like that out of the Mets. Okay, we'll deal him, but you got to give me somebody really good. We're not going to just go out and deal him for the Brett Gardners of the world type thing. You know what I mean? So I like that. So are they going to make any other deals? Really, their biggest holes right now are first base and shortstop. I think that's pretty much established. Their bullpen is their bullpen. Bullpens, to me, I'm not big into making splashes money-wise in bullpens because they're so hit or miss.
Right.
They might have four arms in the minor leagues we've never heard of that can come up and be the next David Robertson. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Remember you asked Tanya Sturts that? You said, you know, dude, what is the deal with a reliever being a 1.9 ERA guy 1 year, and next year he's like a 5?
Yeah.
And Sturts, I don't know.
That's none of them know it.
Good, solid relief pitcher. Nobody knows the answer.
That's the answer of relievers. It's so true. You look at Heath Bell. You look at Eric Gagne. You've got to give you a million guys that are like, you know, look at Fernando Rodney. There's a million guys. For Jose Valverde. Like, there's a million guys like that. So, to me, I'm not a guy who wants to go make a splash and just buy all these relievers because they're all hit or miss.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to get a stat like a Joe Nathan, they're going to get him. They got Bobby Parnell. He's going to be their closer because he's under control. Fine. I don't mind that. So, they got first base needs and they got shortstop needs. So, the real thing is Stephen Drew. Now, people are saying that Stephen Drew's asking price is astronomical, which surprises me. Why is his asking price astronomical? He's a very good defensive shortstop.
Yeah.
Very good. Way above average.
Played great in the playoffs.
Borderline, he can't hit for a lot.
No.
But borderline gold glove shortstop.
Yeah.
So why is his asking price, whatever they're saying, I mean, they're saying this guy's going to be making 12 to 15 per?
That can't
for
fit.
Stephen Drew. I wouldn't want the Mets to sign him for that.
I've admitted to you on this show a multitude of times, I'm horrible at predicting salaries. Like, I never would have ever guessed 7.5 for Chris Young, and I never would have guessed $153 million or whatever it was for Ellsbury.
Yeah.
So I would never pay Stephen Drew $12 million.
I would say he was a 4-for-32 guy.
$8 million a year, really?
I would say he's at.
You know more than I do.
Well, I mean, look,
money,
I mean, you look at guys, what they make. I just base up guys what make an arbitration.
How old is he? Is he like 30?
Yeah, he's probably 30, 31. I mean, he's like in the prime of his career. I would give him 3-4 years,
so
at 8 per.
So you would take him as your shortstop at 8 per for 4 years.
Yeah.
And then what do you do at first base?
Well, then it's going to be an idea of whether you could trade Duda or Davis. I think Davis got more trade value. Either one of them, to me, is a crapshoot.
I know. It's amazing.
I wanted Justin Morneau, and I've said it on our site for 8 months. Obviously now Morneau is with Colorado. He's going to be a guy for the fantasy fans out there. He's going to put up good numbers at Colorado. I'll tell you that right
now.
They
made a nice little move. Brett Anderson.
Yeah, they did some things.
Justin Morneau.
Brett Anderson was the guy that Richard Huntington really wanted.
Yeah.
And they got rid of Fowler. So, I mean, I think that they – first base is an issue for sure. To be honest with you, what I would do at first base, if you could possibly get rid of Duda and Davis, I'd just put Wilmer Flores at first base.
Yeah.
He's a guy, I know he came, they were hoping he was going to be a second baseman. He was a third baseman, they were going to be a second baseman. He's a big body. I mean, he's got the, if you look at him, he looks just like Miguel Cabrera. Everybody says that. Whether he's going to put up the numbers or not, I'd rather give him a chance to play first. His minor league numbers are fantastic. So, and I watch him play. This guy's got that opposite field power. He looks like a David Wright, to be honest with you, because he hits the ball into the right center field gap. I think a guy that's has handled himself at third base and has played around the infield can handle himself at first base. I don't think that first base is the place that you could just stick anybody, but I think you could stick any infielder there. You know what I mean?
Who's the better player, statistically, 5 years from now between Duda and Davis? Wherever they end up. Like, you know, similar ballparks. I'm not saying one goes to Colorado, one goes to Oakland. But if they played in similar on the same team in, like, Tampa Bay, who's the better hitter?
This is going to be almost an admission of me being wrong, which I don't normally like to do, but I'll admit when I'm wrong. I think that Ike Davis will find a place somewhere in the major leagues and be semi-successful. I said when he came up, and then people were like, he's untradeable, and I said his cap is going to be Adam LaRoche. That's the type of player he's going to be. He's going to be a guy who could hit home runs and go on these crazy streaks. We'll have a week where he could be player of the week. But over the long run, he's going to be a 250 hitter with 25 home runs and 80 RBIs, which is going to be better than Duda. When I first saw Duda, I looked at him, and I'm like, this guy's got a pretty swing. He just – it's very long is the problem with his swing. And I haven't seen enough of him at first base to think that he could hold up at first base. Ike Davis is a gold glove caliber first baseman. I think Ike Davis is going to be the better player in another situation in the long run.
See,
I think neither of them are going to succeed at Citi Field.
Yeah, see, I would lean towards Duda, and I don't watch anywhere near the amount of Mets games that you do. Ike, to me, and I like Ike, and I've said that. I like everything about him. I like how he's self-effacing when he's stinking it up, and he's not one of these guys that hides or leaves the ballpark and doesn't talk to everybody. He handles what he has to handle in the biggest media market in our country, if not the world.
Yeah.
I just don't know if that swing is fixable. I mean, they sent him to the minors. He still has the hitch. He still looks off.
Steps in the bucket.
I was just going to say, he gets that old bucket foot going.
A lot of guys have hitches.
Yeah, but they have bad speed. Paul Molitor had a little hitch.
Yeah.
But Paul Molitor's on the bat like a cobra.
I always say about the hitches, like, you know, Sosa had a hitch. He was able to do it.
Yeah.
Gary Sheffield has a huge hitch.
Biggest hitch of all time, Mel Ott's got 500 homers. You ever see that one? He used to drop the bat down off his private area.
Yeah.
That's how his hitch was.
He hit it off his brajol and just drop it.
Off his brajol and just hit it out of the bullpen. But, I, you know what, I'm not a guy that sits here and says I know everything. I don't know if Davis is fixable, and I hope he is because he seems like a good guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's long, so I know, like, you know, I remember the first time I saw him, like, nobody in their right mind. It's just amazing to me that he's gotten as far, like, he was at Arizona State or whatever. They allowed that hitch and the step in the bucket to
him and Brett Wallace.
I mean, I went to Johns Hopkins. They wouldn't have allowed me to do that. You know what I mean?
The
Babber would not have allowed me to do that. All right, we're going to go out to the Tucci Lumber Hotline now. We've got another caller on. We're going to go out to line two. You are on with the Tri-State Sports Guys, Mike and Dan. Who's this?
It's Nick from Norwalk.
Nicky, how we doing, brother? What do you got for us?
I was just listening to a little Mets breakdown there, and I was just coming home there from ShopRite, and Sweeney and was on the Fan, and they had the beat writer there from the Daily News doing the Mets breakdown, and so I was getting my dose of Mets on the way home, and then I sat down and I tuned into you guys, and you guys are talking Mets, so I figured we'd talk a little Mets baseball. From what I hear, it looks like Ruben Tejada is going to stay as the shortstop there for the Mets. I guess the Mets are sending him to two off-season strengthening programs. He did one, and they're sending him again for one in January. So it looks like they're going to stick with Tejada at short. I mean, Stephen Drew's looking for, like, some crazy four-year deal. I don't know. Like Dan said, I couldn't guess the salary, but the way these – salaries are going, he could be a $35-40 million, you know, four-year player, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were talking about. I mean, apparently his asking price is somewhere in the ballpark of like Johnny Peralta, and I thought Johnny Peralta was overpaid. So yeah,
he's way overpaid.
I agree, and so there's this, you know, there's this feeling around the Mets fans that we should be spending more money, we should be spending more money, but I don't want to spend $60 million on Johnny Peralta. I don't want to spend $50 million on Stephen Drew. I mean, there's a point where you want to have a payroll that's, like, you know, competitive with other teams, but if the asking prices don't make sense, then you pass on them. So I understand. I mean, as much as I am not a fan of Ruben Tejada, and I think he's got some laziness in him, and I think he can be a solid glove at short. He's not going to give you any pop, but I do see him giving you good at-bats and giving you lengthy 8-9 pitch at-bats. So if this guy can bet you 270 and you're paying him $600,000, I'd rather have that than just overpay crazy for a guy like Peralta or Drew. I mean, look what Drew did in the playoffs. Drew's not a big bat either.
He was horrible. He got what, that one hit in the playoffs there? That was it. He was like 0 for 12 in the, you know, in the World Series or so. I don't know. He was just horrible in the playoffs. That's all I can remember. And then when hearing it, the Yankees were looking at him. But on the other hand, the Yankees are scared to go 4 years with Omar Infante. That's what's holding up that deal. Infante wants 4 years. Yankees don't want to give him a fourth year, which I don't get. They're just spending. Why not just give him the fourth year? Because, I mean, if you think about it, the Yankees don't have any – I mean, there's not one infield position that's locked up. We don't know what you're getting with Teixeira. Second base is up in the air. Jeter's only going to play, I'm guessing, 120 games at short. And I'm assuming the Yankees are going on the premise that A-Rod's not going to be playing because, you know, I just, with the Kelly Johnson signing and, you know, the talks that maybe they're going to trade Nunez and they brought back Ryan in short, you know, I don't know. There's just not a lot of good infielders out there. There's, you know, I mean, Stephen Drew, Omar Infante, Peralta, those guys, you're going to give $50 million to those guys? I mean, come on.
Well, exactly. I mean, just because you have some money to spend and you have a need doesn't mean you go out and make a stupid contract, which we're talking about. I mean, like we talked about Omar Infante, we talked about him during the Kinsler trade. I almost didn't like it for the Tigers' perspective because Omar Infante is a serviceable second baseman. The guy will hit you 300 You know, 10 home runs, that type of guy, play a good second base, could play all around the field. But let's not pretend that Omar Infante is a $15 million a year guy. And if that's what his asking price is over a multi-year deal, it's like, what are you talking about?
I mean, these guys want 4 years, 40, 50, you know what I mean? I guess Peralta set the market on what his, you know, whatever the cards, would he pay him 4 years, 50 mil or something? I mean, he's setting the market for these mid-range, you know, infielders that, I mean, they're not Robinson Cano. And I mean, it took me a few days to get over it, but I'm looking at the Cano deal as, you know, I guess it's a relief now that, you know, he's gone and, you know, they signed Beltran in his place. But, you know, unless you're Pedroia or Cano, there's really, I can't name too many really good second basemen off the top of my head that I'd want to invest 4 or 5 years in aside from those two, right?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat, but I will tell you this, and I wrote an article for the site about Robinson Cano. That loss is something that the Yankees are not going to be able to recoup. The best hitting second baseman in 20 years, consistently, the guy plays – I mean, all the people that call him lazy, this guy came out there for 6-7 straight years and averaged 160 games a year, gold glove caliber second base. But I blame Yankee fans for this because – they didn't appreciate what they had. This guy, all this guy did was get crapped on over and over for the fact that he was lazy and run out ground balls. They didn't appreciate what they had. So now you know what? He's gone. And now you guys got to deal with it. And you're going to have to deal with some random second baseman, whether it's Kelly Johnson or somebody else, and you're going to say, oh, my God, I wish we had Robinson Cano. And there's no way you're going to fill it in with adding a fifth outfielder, sixth. I mean, how many outfielders are you guys going to give $10 million to?
They're trying to shop Gardner, and nobody wants him. So that right there shows, you know. Apparently, they've been trying to shop Ichiro and Gardner to the Giants for one of their pitchers, Bumgardner, Kane, or something, some kind of package. But I guess that's not going to happen.
You're never going to give away Ichiro for anything. The guy's a 260 hitter with a 280 on base.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, and then there's Vernon Wells,
player for him.
You know, but. You know, you're right, Cano. We're not going to make up those numbers, but I mean, it's funny. I went to the last home game there, the Marianos game. I was sitting next to a guy up there that was booing Cano the whole time, and we were talking. And Cano made the last out there at Yankee Stadium that final game there at home, and he was, you know, he was happy. He just looked. He was like, "Thank God you're gone." He knew. He knew right away they weren't going to sign Cano. He saw. I could see it in his eyes. He's like, "They're not going to sign him." I'm like, well, I guess. All right. You know, I'm like, you know, I was kind of at that point. I was like, "No, there's no way. You know, Cano's coming back. He's a lifetime Yankee." But I mean, looking back at that day and looking at that guy boo Cano, and you know, I mean, he was screaming the craziest stuff at him. I mean, and I'm sitting up in the grandstands. He couldn't hear it, but I mean. Every time he was at bat, he was booing the crap out of him. And I couldn't figure it out for the life of me. But now, you know, I guess now I can see it. Why, you know?
Yeah, it amazes me, Nick. And, you know, it amazes me the Yankee fans didn't appreciate what they had. But what are we going to do? I mean, they're going to regret it. I'm telling you that right now. I mean, you might not see the Mariners go out and do fantastic things. And his numbers might decline and everything. But you knew you had a known commodity at second base. And you let him walk away because you weren't willing to pay an extra 3 years because all of a sudden the Yankees are worrying about what their lineup is going to look like in 2020, which is not the Yankees that I grew up watching. Fine. Do you guys want this new Yankees that want to deal with prospects? And then now, go ahead. That's what you guys got. But thank you for the call, Nick. We got a guest coming on in a little bit. We got to take a quick commercial break. That's the great Nick from Norwalk. He's always so he's active on our Facebook page, so you can always check us out, tristatesportsguys.com or facebook.com/tristatesportsguys or @tristate_sports. Coming up, we got the great Mark Long, Road Rules fam, and we got him coming up in a little bit. He's going to tell us some get fit tips.
What?
Get fit tips.
Yep.
For the Thanksgiving and Christmas. We'll be right back with Tri-State Sports Guys.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Really, Really, Really Bad Dancer.
Mr. Really, Really, Really Bad Dancer.
arms swinging, knees bending, head bobbing to no particular rhythm. You're either dancing or you have fleas.
Call me a doctor.
As soon as you hit the dance floor, the taunts begin. Is that all you got, playa? Unfortunately, yes, that's all you got.
Pour it on now.
Who's in the house? Some guy who can't dance. That's who's in the house.
You're
so crack open an ice-cold Bud Light, Mr. Happy Feet, because you really put the oogie in boogie.
Mr. Really, really bad
answer. All right, we're back with the Tri-State Sports Guys. Danny's got some nerve making fun of me because I – say it real fast.
Get fit tips.
Get fit tips. That's hard to do.
No.
But I muscled my way through it like
great.
A professional.
Yeah.
You spent 47 seconds trying to figure out Brandon Miller's name.
Hey, you know what?
It rolls off my tongue.
I made a mistake.
Yeah, and you know what? That's on your that blood's on your hands.
I forgive myself, but meanwhile, I made a new friend tonight in Tad Boyle. So
that's your best friend,
I'm
Tad
be
Boyle.
Okay.
All right. Well, we are going to go out to the Tucci Lumber Hotline. We got a couple good guests tonight. We got another great one on the line for you now. This guy, fans at home might know him from Road Rules. They might know him from The Real World. He's been on a million different things. This guy's busier than anybody I know. So on the Tucci Lumber Hotline, we got Mark Long. Are you with us, Mark?
Yeah. How you guys doing?
Good. How you doing, Mark?
Good. Coming in hot from Melbourne Beach, Florida. How about that?
A little bit nicer than Norwalk, Connecticut, where we're sitting on about 20-degree weather and a half inch of ice on my driveway. But, yeah, you guys are doing pretty nice down there. So how you doing? So you're a Florida guy, right? You went to University of Florida.
Yeah, I went to University of Florida. I feel your pain because I was in Dallas the last 2 days, and Dallas was like frozen tundra. So I feel your pain up there in Connecticut. But, yeah, I'm a Florida guy.
So let me ask you this. I mean, we had the guy who runs the Seminole.com website on earlier, Brandon Miller. So, I mean, is this going to be hard for you, this bowl season here as a UF guy? I mean, is it going to be hard for you to be watching the Florida State Seminoles in the national championship game?
Yeah, well, I actually grew up in a household. I have one older brother. He was 4 years older, and he is a Seminole. So we grew up with half the house being Seminole, half the house being Gators. But I will say this, my stretch at the Gators was way better than his stretch in FSU. So he was due. So I'm glad they're doing well this year. And but I got to tell you, I fear for them because I think Auburn's going to beat them. I hate to say it on live radio, but I feel like Auburn's going to hand it to them.
Wow, that's a bold statement. I mean, this is a team that came out with two crazy endings to a game, and my co-host here, Danny's a big college football guy. Up here in the Northeast, we're mostly pro sports, so I let Danny handle that stuff. But I just feel like Florida State's like a team to root for, so I'm kind of pulling for him. Jameis Winston, all the stuff he went through and all that. So, you know, it is what it is.
I'm just glad. I watched him a few weeks ago, and Jameis Winston was squinting so bad on his close-ups when they were shooting. I think they finally made him wear contacts. So the last game, I didn't see him squint one time. So God bless him for wearing his contacts during the game.
I was that guy. I'm one of those guys that needed contacts, and I fought it. I used to sit in center field in college and try to peer in to see the catcher, and I'm like, I need contacts. So God bless him. You're exactly right. Now, Mark,
hey,
I
feel your pain. I played high school sports, and I didn't get LASIK till college. I used to sit in the outfield, and when I heard the ball hit, if no one else moved, then I knew it was coming my way.
And then you reacted. Oh, boy.
Let me
ask you this, Mark. So you're one of those guys that got onto this reality show wave way ahead of the curve. I mean, to me, Real World was the first reality show. I remember I'm in middle school and, like, everybody was watching. It was like must-watch television in the early 90s. You got in on that. You got in on Road Rules. So you caught that wave early. And and obviously you stayed very active. You're still very active in after shows or different shows throughout the thing. Talk about that run. I mean, like you said, you're at University of Florida. You could have never envisioned that, you know, 15 years later, you know, you'd be doing what you're doing, right?
No, exactly. And I remember, it's funny you said that, because I was one of those guys that watched the first Real World sitting in my parents' living room. I was home one time, and then my roommate in college said, hey, you should send in a video for one of these shows. And I randomly did it, thinking nothing of it. But then, you know, 6 months down the interview process, you get the final call, and Yeah, I want to say I love doing it. Every time I go back, it's such a cool thing to do because we usually go to such cool locations, and it's just literally like going to it's like going to spring break meets the Wild West because you go down there and you feel like there's no laws. You can do anything you want. You don't have to worry about feeding yourself or putting a roof over your head, and it's just complete mayhem. But, yeah, I've done well in all the shows, man. I made it to most of the finals. Been on a ton of challenges, hosted a ton of after shows. And I mean, my last challenge was a year and a half ago, so I've been blessed, man. I'm 42 years old now, so I'm hanging with the young kids still.
Yeah, I mean, you're hanging with guys that were watching you when they were in, you know, elementary school. Now,
yeah,
Mark,
it's the worst. They'll say, when was your first show? And I'll say 95. They'll be like, I was 8 years old. And I'm like, thanks for aging me, bro.
That's what I'm saying, dude. They didn't even watch the Mets win the World Series. They had another idea.
No.
Now, let me, I mean,
no,
Mark,
no.
To be honest, I mean, you and I are both very good-looking guys. So
yeah,
this is a tough time.
Yeah, we can admit that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, you know what I mean? But you know what? My co-host is not happy with that. But so it's a blessing and a curse, Mark. So, you know, you get to the holiday season, and obviously the temptations are there, but you feel a responsibility to look sharp at your all times. Now, I've seen your pictures. You're still in very good shape. So, I mean, what's the secret? I know you got a lot of things going on book-wise. You got a lot of, you know, protein things going on. What's the secret at this time? Give it like, to my co-host, Dan, who might have a little more trouble with his temptations. Tell me a little bit about what he should be doing.
Here's the proper way to do it, and it's not brain surgery. It's not rocket science. But this is why I got into my product. The product that I'm doing now is Pocket Protein. You can go to pocketprotein.com, read all about it. It's actually up in the Northeast now, in Wegmans, ShopRite, Bed Bath & Beyond, so it's up there. But here's the deal with protein, and I figured this out late in the game. Protein keeps you fuller longer. So if you eat protein before you eat the snacks and the crap, you won't eat as much because you'll be fuller, and it keeps your, you know, it's mind over matter. If your body and your mind feel full, you're not going to reach for that extra third, fourth, or fifth cookie. So I like to load up with protein in the morning. It kind of keeps me full throughout the day. And, of course, everyone has that cheat day. I love having the cheat day. I think The Rock from WWE has a huge cheat day like myself. You pick that one day where you really go crazy and eat anything you want. I mean, I remember going to Mrs. Fields and having dinner of all cookies because I knew it was my cheat day. But the other days, I would keep on a pretty strict diet. If I was going to cheat, I'd up my protein so I was fuller longer. And I just, you know, if you keep protein in your system, your body just feels full, and you won't reach for those bag of chips. You won't reach for the extra five cookies, you know what I'm saying? I'm not saying avoid the holidays, but I'm saying do it smart and do it the right way. And I think if you balance out that and use that strategy, you're going to win in the holidays. I say turn holiday hell into holiday healthy, my man. I just made that up.
That, I like it, and we're going to use that. You know what we're going to do too, Mark? We're going to put out a contest to our listeners. We're going to get well, – look, I mean, let's be honest. We're up in the Northeast. We got a lot of guineas that just eat pasta like myself. So we got a lot of guys that are a little out of shape. We're going to put out a contest to our listeners. We're going to pay for it. We're going to get them a month's supply, 45-day supply, whatever you think it would take to make a difference of the pocket protein, and we're going to give weekly updates on our website to see how it goes. I think it can work, right?
Absolutely. And like you said, when you said a bunch of people up there eat pasta, it's simple. Eat a pocket, drink a pocket protein before your pasta. You're not going to eat as much, and you're going to balance out those carbohydrates, and it's going to last longer, and you will lose weight. Because here's the deal: if you're not hungry, you won't eat as much, and you won't take in as much calories, and you'll lose the weight. But I totally agree with that, and I think it's a good strategy. And I mean, I've been in situations before where I've been to like a brunch or I've been to like a, you know, a buffet, and I'm just seeing rolls and pasta and carbs, and they don't have, you know, a great portable source of protein. A lot of people gain the weight when they're traveling or they're busy because they don't have an easy access. Pocket protein is the perfect way. It doesn't need refrigeration. You could take it anywhere. They're in 2-ounce foil packs, and I guarantee you the Northeast will get skinny if they hit those stores and buy Pocket Protein. I guarantee it.
All right. Well, what we're going to do, we're going to put the link on our site. And we're going to put it out to our listeners. We're going to pick, we'll figure out a way to pick the winner. And we're going to pay for it. We'll give them a month's supply, whatever it is. I mean, so how often do these guys got to drink this? Just before meals or what's the process of it?
This is our theory. If you take two a day, we say two a day and you keep the hunger away. So if you take two a day, if you're taking them when you feel a little hungry, most people feel hungry after, you know, between that that lunch hour and that dinner hour when they're at work or on the road, they feel that hunger, so they'll grab chips or grab crap. Take a pocket protein then. It bridges the gap so you can go home and have a sensible meal. There's two things people fear, getting fat and getting old, and pocket protein can help assist in both because the protein helps you stay thin, and there's collagen protein in there, too, for your skin, hair, and nails, which keeps you skin. Collagen is definitely proven to diminish fine lines and wrinkles. So we'll hook you up. You guys can start looking skinny and young up there in the Northeast.
We're going to do it. It's a done deal. We're definitely doing it. Now, I got one more question. This was actually emailed to us, and I have to ask it. Out of all the challenges you were either on or you judged or whatever, who's the hottest chick you saw? I have to ask it. I mean, there's got to be one girl that's like not on. I saw this girl in person.
You know. Can I give two?
Yeah.
Can I give two?
What do we got up here in Norwalk?
First one, there's a girl named Kellyanne. Do you guys remember her? I think she was in Real World Sydney. You guys got to Google Kellyanne when we hang up. Next.
Mm-hmm.
There's a girl, Ashley, who was on the Real World San Diego, the second version of San Diego, a little blonde girl who's really attractive. And I'll tell you, back in the heyday, man, Robin, the girl that I dated, she was up there, man. She had the Marilyn Monroe curves, the huge...
Oh, I remember her. See, I remember. That's back in my day when I was watching that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember her. She was smoking hot.
There's actually, you know, it's funny. There's not just one. There's about a half a dozen that I'd like to, get deserted on an island with a bunch of booze. You know what I mean?
My God, my producer's starting to throw some pictures up. My God, dude, I need to get. How can I get on a reality show? They don't want to do a reality show about a sports talk show. I mean, look, we're very interesting people, all of us. Pull
on
connections and say I got these guys up in Connecticut that want to do a reality show. We're very interesting.
You know what you got to do, and I tell everyone this, like, how do I go? You just got to make a tape, man. You got to make a tape and send it in your favorite show and just be a complete lunatic on your tape. If you're a lunatic on your tape, that transfers to ratings for these guys. So the tape I sent in originally from University of Florida, I mean, I did so much in this tape, you would have thought I was, like, the busiest, most coolest guy in the world. And it was all planned and staged, but they didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, my guy's saying Ashley's the guy that takes the cake. But, yeah, you know, we got my co-host here. Let him talk about Kansas basketball. That's crazy enough. I mean, this guy had the coach of Colorado on this tonight and, you know, who beat Kansas this weekend. And, I mean, he was frothing at the mouth. So, yeah, we could make a tape, no problem, Mark. So,
yeah.
But,
Mark,
we really appreciate it. We really appreciate your time. I know it's late on a Wednesday and you're in some gorgeous town down in Florida, Melbourne. So really appreciate your time. We're going to post all your stuff up on our site. We're going to get this challenge going to one of our lucky listeners. And you know what? We'll keep an update. See, hopefully they stick to it and they lose some weight, all right?
Absolutely, and they will. And keep me posted. Let me know how it goes.
We absolutely will. We'll let you guys know how it's going. So thank you very much. That's Mark Long. Good guy, dude.
Thank you, guys.
Amazing. Posting his picture up on our site. My God, that guy's a good-looking fellow. I mean, he's a guy I can relate to.
Yeah.
He's a guy I can see eye to eye to. You know what I mean?
You know what I'm curious about?
Why
can I eat a number one from Duchess, and then if you put a cheesesteak from Pat's in Philly right in front of me, I'm not hungry at all. I feel like I'm on death's door. I'll eat the whole thing.
Eat the whole shebang.
I don't think any protein's going to help me, but I'd be willing to try it.
Yeah. I mean, I can go
why am I not
face deep in a broccoli Robin sausage. Like,
yeah.
Just crush it. And be like, oh, you bringing out another dish? Yeah, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, let's talk about this for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
You go to the bathroom before, you know? You come back out.
Yeah.
Your hair's done.
Yeah. My hair, I have good hair.
No. But it wasn't done. You.
You want to know why? I'll be honest with you.
And then you have the gall to tell him how good looking you are?
Listen.
Just took a pee break. It's just your hair.
I didn't. We don't have a towel in my bathroom. I rinse, wash my hands. We don't have paper towel. I just went like this. That's all I do.
You guys got beautiful lettuce.
I just use my jeans when I use your bathroom before.
Well, I use my hair.
That's fantastic.
That's what I do.
I want to be like you.
It's my moneymaker, dude. Everybody's got a gift. God gives gifts to everybody in different ways. The gift of this guy, Mark Long, with abs or, you know, all kinds of things.
Yeah. I know how to make a ton of money for this show. Me and you just have a brawl. Right down on O'Neill's bare knuckles. Yeah, you can wipe all the water you want.
And then after you beat my ass, you can just shove protein powder down my face or whatever you got there. But check it out. We're going to do that. We got to get a guy who's going to do a month on this gig here. You
I'll
know what I mean? You'll do it.
I'll absolutely do it.
You going to stick to it, though, dude?
On my mother, I will.
All right. We got some money in our coffers. We're going to buy it. You guys, you're going to stick to it. I want to get weekly updates. Just how are we doing? You don't need to tell me where you started.
No, but
you don't even know where you finished.
Loss.
You can just tell me weight loss.
Absolutely.
Or weight gain. I don't know.
No, it's not going to be weight gain.
It's going to be Zeppelin's over
you
at
you know what it is, man?
I
look like someone. I've lost like 25 pounds in the last 2 months, but it looks like you threw like a deck chair off the Titanic.
Yeah.
Because I'm big, so
yeah, big fella.
So I could lose probably 30 pounds on this guy's protein stuff.
And you look sharp. Come on, you feel in the belt loops? When I lose weight,
my pants are definitely looser.
There you go.
You know,
you're still rocking. You know,
my ass is bigger, but my pants are looser.
But that's where that's your moneymaker.
Yeah.
Mine's my hair.
The girls tell me that.
Yours is your caboose.
Yeah, they like that and my finely trimmed beard. Those
there
are the
you go.
Two things I get.
You think we got some time for some say what?
Only if Tony D's going to do it.
Tony, before you get started, can you give me some Samuel before we get by bring the mic over? I want you to find it. Because if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. We don't always get to it. We don't always have time. We got 10 minutes. You probably haven't even been here for the Samuel.
No.
Well, that's our intro for this. This used to be like our go-to intro.
Say what again? Say what again? I dare you. I double dare you, motherfucker.
I mean, that's an intro. I'm not a guy who like knows all the inside and outs of the bit. That's how you introduce a segment, right? So we got. And every time I think he's going to say the F word, but he doesn't.
He doesn't. Tony runs a tight ship.
Tony, he's got a good finger on that dumb button. All right, Tony D, you got 10 minutes to give us a nice say what. Go ahead, brother.
And I got three of them.
There we go. We only got 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So we'll elaborate.
So, Major League Baseball.
Oh, I'm so glad you bring this up.
They have they're proposing it. I guess
I think it's a done deal.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is too, based on safety and all that stuff that goes on. They're gonna eliminate collisions at home plate.
Nope. Now listen, this is gonna happen, Danny. This is gonna happen this year. This is not like one of those things that theoretically is gonna happen. Now I am a guy who has said like the hockey fights are just dumb because they serve no purpose. You're gonna disagree with me. To me, it's just like a show. Collisions at the plate serve a baseball purpose. The catcher is taught to block the plate, and there's only one way to get to the plate. You're going to try to go around him, you're going to go through him. And they're getting rid of that. This is actually something that's going to impact the game of baseball, and I think it's atrocious that they're doing this. And people are like, it's for the for safety. First of all, you can go you can watch every baseball game in America for a week and not see a collision. It's not like there's something that happens all the time, because half the guys are scared anyway because they're making $100 million a year. So they're scared of it anyway. The few times it happens, the guys don't get hurt. You got the Buster Posey and you got the guy that Pete Rose knocked over.
Ray Fosse.
I mean, it's not like this is like a chronic issue like concussions or something like that. When I heard this, I'm like, this is going to disgust Dan. I don't even need to know your opinion. I know your opinion.
No, you absolutely know my opinion. But do you want me to just let you trash hockey fights again? I mean, let me put it to you.
Can I tell you my point about hockey fights?
Only if it's brief.
It'd be very brief.
Okay.
Here's why my problem. I feel that it's fake. And here's the reason why. Early on in the season, there was that fight that occurred, and the guy fell on his head, and he was like knocked unconscious or whatever. And all of a sudden, the guy who was fighting him became Mr. Concerned Citizen.
Yeah.
So that means it wasn't a real fight. If I'm fighting Tony D, and I'm beating his ass, and he falls on the ground, and he's just like lights out, I'm just getting up and like, yeah, I won that fight. So it's not a real fight.
Well,
a fight does not occur where you win the fight, and the guy's laying on the ground, and all of a sudden you're concerned. That's not how a fight occurs, so let's not call them fights.
No, but you're talking about like a street fight, or like a bar
fight.
A real,
well then they're not.
How about a couple of boxers? I mean, I know that's what they do for a living, but
that's the point of the game.
But
the point of hockey is not the fight.
But the point is this.
The point of hockey is to put the goal in the net.
No.
So tell me what the purpose of hockey is. Because they got enforcers, and they got the thugs.
Well, no, I mean, I've always made the argument. If they wanted to get rid of hockey completely,
the Olympics are exciting?
They absolutely could. The Olympics are fine, but that's not real hockey. And no,
it's not real hockey because
no,
it's
no real hockey. No, because they don't even barely hit each other. That's not the kind of knockdown, drag-out deal. All I'm saying is you got a little guy on your team. He's a goal scorer. Fighting is allowed. You have a team full of guys that can't step up and defend him. They will take his head off in that league.
So why don't you do it in football?
Wayne Gretzky said if it wasn't for Marty McSorley, who scored like 5 goals in his entire career.
I understand that, but why don't you do it in football?
Why don't they? I think it'd be great.
Just let them fight.
I think it would be. I think just, baseball and basketball would be phenomenal if they allowed fighting. And I'm 100% serious when I say.
So you just want fighting in society? Then.
How about this? How
you're gonna say anything? I took instruction.
Remember
some superintendents over there busting my ass.
Remember when
I should just fight
Pedro Martinez threw Gerald Williams and he attacked him and Pedro went down like a little girl and everybody stepped on him? How about if
you're doing your sport?
But how
you
about
don't have
if
Gerald
would just go, okay, here's my bat, and then there's a little ring behind home plate, and they just scrap. Pitchers would stop throwing it, guys. I'm saying,
look,
let them scrap.
Bob Gibson was notorious for throwing, and you're an old school guy.
He was notorious for throwing it, guys, but not hitting guys.
He would have got his ass kicked. He wasn't a big dude. He would have got his ass kicked by some dudes. Don't act like that guy. He acted like a tough guy.
Bob Gibson had a
tough
upbringing.
He acted like
a tough
guy. He threw very hard.
He had a tough upbringing. I think he was a pushover.
I would lay Bob Gibson out.
Now you
look
he's like 75.
Well, hey, that's all I have to compare him to.
And you put a quarter in your hair in the bathroom. Pony, give us another one. I don't want to talk hockey with Mike anymore.
Why do you not like that I look good? I like to look good, Danny, even for you and Tone.
That's sad.
How about this? RG3.
Yeah.
Today got benched.
Yeah.
The last
not only
three.
Benched, he's not even active. The dude is a third string. He's an inactive player. Now, let me ask you this, Danny.
Yeah.
When I heard this, this is what I'm thinking. So, we've had some people even on our site suggest that the Jets should go after Kirk Cousins.
Right.
He's going to be the guy that's available. They drafted him the same year. Obviously, they gave up a lot more for RG3. They gave up their first-round pick, which now might be the first or second pick overall to St. Louis. What if Kirk Cousins comes out and just slings the ball over the yard? I mean, you're a guy who watched college football. You know what kind of quarterback he is. He's a good quarterback.
Michigan State Spartan.
You've seen him. Do you think he could be a big-time NFL quarterback?
Well,
anything that tells you that he couldn't be?
Well, I don't know if he would be a Brady or an Eli, Peyton or Rodgers.
Jay Cutler?
I think he could be better than Jay Cutler.
Okay.
I think he was a better college quarterback than Jay Cutler.
So he's that guy. What if they go out in the next three games, this guy goes out, gives you 250 yards, a couple touchdowns, keeps his interceptions down, this and that. What is to say they don't deal RG3? For a bunch, because they're going to get a lot more for RG3.
Yeah.
You look at the Redskins team, they need a lot more than just a couple little pieces. I mean, they're in shambles right now.
I love your idea.
Why wouldn't they go out and deal him? Because they might be able to get one of those top 10 picks.
But apparently, and you know, you have to know this because I know it, apparently Dan Snyder's in love with him.
He's in love with him.
So I don't see that happening, but I agree with you. If Cousins comes out, how many games left? Three or four?
There's three games.
Three left. Say he throws like seven touchdowns.
I love that about you. You don't even know how many games left.
No, I don't even care. Seven touchdowns and an interception, okay?
And you can tell you about the right quarterback, but you don't even know how many games are left. I love that.
Say he throws for 900 yards, seven touchdowns and a pick.
Slings it all around the yard.
And you went out and traded Griffin for whatever holes they might have to fill, which has to be a bevy of them.
For Griffin, they
think
it
would
be a bevy of picks.
But how
is
Snyder ever
going to
do it?
NFL ready.
No.
I think a lot of it has to do with what they gave up to get him, which I think is a stupid mentality. You already gave that up.
Yeah.
That sucks. You gave it up. You had your good year. You got it out. You know, he did have this resurgence. At this point, you see what RG3 is, and we all thought he was this great guy because all the storylines behind him at Baylor, he was this great guy. I mean, you're running Mike Shanahan out. This is a borderline Hall of Fame head coach. You're running him out of town. I'm not going to tell you you're a good guy anymore. If you're a guy who can't get along with Mike Shanahan, who coached John Elway.
Remember what Salisbury said to us last week? Salisbury said he wants to see the quarterback who gets knocked down, picks himself up, doesn't blame anybody.
No, he's
it's
blaming
nobody's
Santana
fault,
Moss.
And he's blaming Santana Moss, who's my father's age.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So,
he's not that guy.
No.
Even the one, I mean, I could bash Geno Smith all I want, but at least Geno Smith takes his lumps and just says, I got to get better, I got to get better,
I
or whatever.
Stunk, so it's my fault.
Well, I got to get better, and I think I'm good, but I'm going to get better. RG3 is like pass the buck to somebody else, which almost starts to look a little bit like the Vince Young types.
Yeah,
the guys like that type of guy who could have some success, and then when things go bad, it's never his fault. Hands up, never his fault.
Yeah.
So why is it outrageous to think that they could get rid of him?
It's not.
You get like Jacksonville or something like that. Jacksonville will say, "I'll give you my first round pick."
One of the talking
heads, and then they have a top 10 pick.
One of the talking heads on the NFL Network yesterday was I forget who it was, but he was saying how the arc of the Redskins and the Cowboys is the same because you have two owners that are so hands on. That nothing positive ever seems to get done. I don't think Griffin's a bad player. I think he could be a bad teammate, which could be just as detrimental.
At quarterback, it would be.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're talking about maybe a
bad
leadership.
Yeah, you
get
a bad defensive lineman, you're like, whatever. You know, the guy's a douche,
right.
But whatever. All right, Tony, you got one more?
One last thing, real quick. I saw this on PTI for a hot second the other day, so I'm going to steal it from them. Wes Welker, not playing this week. Got a second concussion in like, I don't know, 2-3 weeks. To retire?
Yeah, I don't know if it's time for him to retire because he could still be productive. If you get a couple concussions like that, little guy.
This year, I mean, he's got him over.
Yeah, no, I know. That's what I'm saying. He's probably got a half dozen in his career.
Yeah.
Look, I don't know. You can't ever make that judgment. I would need a doctor to tell me he needs to shut down. I don't know the medical science behind how many concussions it takes to make you, you know, like have debilitative issues. But you look at some of these guys that age and are having big-time problems. Yeah, I mean, I think that somebody needs to step in and talk to him. If he's had this many concussions and now he's had 2 in this year, I mean, you're a little guy going over the middle like he does.
Remember that PBS documentary I talked to you about? You said you hadn't seen it?
Yeah.
You seen it yet?
No.
Watch it.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you tell a guy like Welker to retire, which is why the more I look at Adrian Peterson, I look at it like they're never going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
He's going to just keep getting crushed, and who wants to see that guy? Like, you see Favre talking to Matt Lauer a couple weeks ago. Forgets things.
He said he forgot his whole daughter's summer, whatever, softball league or whatever it was. Forgot the whole thing. All right, well, thank you to everybody that came on, Mark Long, Tad Boyle, Brandon Miller. Check us out every week, TriStateSportsGuys.com, Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys or at @TriState_sports on Twitter. We've got a great lineup, so check us out. Thanks.